Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you for joining today's web conference, ISO Congestion Revenue Rights, CRR, training. With that, I'm going to turn the call over to Rhonda Madrigal. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Tegan. We're going to go ahead and do some announcements for the folks in the room here, and then we'll go ahead and get started. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So welcome, everybody. I'm Todd Deinhardt with PacifiCorp, the project manager on the ISO project. I think, as everyone knows, this is a CRR training being provided by Rhonda and Jim that we'll be going through. Before I turn it over to them, I want to do a few announcement-type deals. For those of you in the room, you can see on the wall we set up guest Wi-Fi for everyone. And if you have issues, we do have an IT technical person here, Prima, who is over in the corner who can help you with that. A safety message for those of us in the room, if we have a safety incident, we'll head outside the double doors to the mall where you came in, go down the stairs or the ramp, hang a left, go out the double doors again, and you'll go into the parking garage, and we'll meet all out there if that should happen, and you'll hear the alarms in the building. And then when it comes time for lunch as well, there is not a lunch being served, but right out here in the food court at the mall, there is a lunch. Any questions? Perfect. I'll turn it over to Rhonda. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us here today. We are here for the purpose of providing you with an overview of ISO congestion revenue rights. So myself, Rhonda Madrigal, I'm one of the client trainers at the California ISO, and I have Jim McLean over here to my right. And Jim, you're a
lead for the
CRR group. Like, I don't have your title memorized. And so we're here today to give you a basic understanding of CRRs and to answer any questions that you may have. We're wanting to make this session really interactive. We're here for about 4 hours with an also an hour break for lunch, and so we want to make sure that, you know, whatever questions you've brought here today get answered for you. So as I'm going through the slides and the material, feel free to raise your hand, or for those folks of you that are joining us on the phone, let Tegan know by raising your hand that you have a question. And we'll go ahead and get those answers answered for you. I did have a few notes that I wanted to share. The purpose of today's session is to educate the audience. So, Tegan, could you move to the next slide, please? The purpose for today's session is to educate the audience, to provide a foundational understanding of how CRRs work and what it could mean for the stakeholders should PacifiCorp decide to integrate into a regional ISO. There are a number of items that need to be explored as PacifiCorp is working through the process of deciding whether or not to go down this road. With regard to CRRs, we at the ISO are gathering modeling and contract information, working with PacifiCorp to do so, and we're going to use this data for a market simulation that we're going to be doing in 2017, a market simulation for CRRs. In order for this market simulation to be effective, we will need you, the stakeholders, to participate in that as well as or along with PacifiCorp. I will expect that PacifiCorp will be reaching out to you with more information at the appropriate time, so please keep your eye out for that type of notification in order to participate and have an effective CRR market simulation. We need to have folks other than just PacifiCorp participating. So the focus of today's session really is how do CRRs work today? If you have questions or comments today related to CRR policy, or if you have suggestions about how or ways you think the CRR process could be improved, that's not really the focus of today's session. There will be other opportunities for you and other stakeholder functions for that type of conversation. Really today, the reason we're gathered here is, the reason we're gathered here today is to understand what CRRs are. It's a lot of R's. So we've got an agenda here on the screen. We're going to do a little introduction, which is kind of what we're doing now. We'll get a look at or a brief overview of the ISO market and congestion revenue rights, and we'll go over the timeline. We have annual processes and monthly processes, so we'll give you a feel for kind of how that works. Then we'll go through the allocation and the auction process. There's two different processes with regard to CRRs. And then at the end, we'll go over settlements, the money piece of it, or the financial aspects, and what is involved there. And we also have some additional financial considerations to share with you. Could we move to the next slide, please, Tegan? Thank you. Another thing that I wanted to mention, the focus of today's session, we're presenting this material at a high level. So Jim and I kind of sat down and compiled these slides for you today. There is a lot of information and a lot of detail with regard to CRRs. We could be here for not just 4 hours, but maybe a day and a half, probably. So we kind of took the information and we made it concise. We kept it at a high level, and we've simplified some of the processes. So I put this slide here kind of as a disclaimer, not necessarily for the folks attending in the room today, but for you later when you're looking at the material. I wanted to kind of make sure that you understood that there's other things, other details and nuance that is involved that may be more spelled out in the tariff or our business practice manual. At the ISO, we have a number of business practice manuals, which are kind of guides for how we implement the rules of the tariff. So the tariff will have a number of rules that we need to follow, and the business practice manual shows you the process that we go through to actually implement those. So there are a lot of details that we're not going to go into. I'm not going to go through slides and slides of calculations and things like that. That's not a large audience conversation. So just wanted to kind of set the stage there. I do have, I think, a settlement calculation that we walk through at the very end at a very basic level. But most of this material is kind of kept at a high level to help you understand how things work overall. And, of course, as I said, if you have any questions as we're going through the material, please feel free to raise your hand. We want to make sure that you leave here having answers to the questions that you came here with. And another thing, too, I can tend to get a little excited sometimes when I'm talking and maybe move a little fast. So if you feel like the pace is going too fast, please let me know. I'm speaking, but I'm not really listening to myself speaking, if that makes sense. And so I don't want to be going too fast and be losing folks. So, Tegan, can we move to the next slide, please? Thank you. So the next topic we're going to talk about is the ISO market and congestion revenue rights. And I don't know, should I pause every time we want to move to the next slide, or should I ask you, what would be the easiest for you?
The easiest for me would be saying next slide.
Okay, let's do that then. All right, so first of all, we wanted to give you just a brief overview of the ISO market, a handful of slides to kind of put this in context for you. So the ISO market offers a full network model. You'll hear the term FNM referred to. And this analyzes generation and transmission schedules submitted a day in advance to better manage or avoid real-time bottlenecks. I did want to point out also, since I've already used one acronym, I have at the end of the slide presentation a list of all of the acronyms that we're going to go through. I'm going to try to spell out first in complete words before I resort to using the acronyms, but if you lose track of what that acronym stands for, if you flip to the back of the presentation, you can see we've included a list there for you. I also have some other notes on the FNM that I wanted to share with you. So the full network model is a representation of the generation and the transmission in our system. With the model, we're able to see where there might be constraints on the grid. So that's what when we talk about the full network model, it's actually a representation of the physical layout of the system. Along with that, we have what's called an integrated forward market, or IFM. You'll hear that referred to that way as well, that provides a one-stop shop for trading and for analyzing electricity bids, transmission capacity, and reserves needed to keep the grid in balance. We also have locational marginal pricing, which is electricity pricing based on the cost of generating and delivering it. So the LMP, you'll hear that acronym a lot, takes account of congestion when determining energy prices. It reflects the value of energy at the specific location and time that it is delivered. The LMPs send price signals that identify congestion and encourage new transmission or demand response initiatives or new generation in areas where congestion is common. Next slide, please. So just a high-level timeline with regard to the day-ahead market. The ISO has two markets. In day-ahead, we have, let me see here. I have to unlock it. In the day-ahead market, we have an integrated forward market, which commits generation, clears energy bids, procures ancillary services, and manages congestion. I'll have to remember for the folks in the room, I need to move my mouse so that the screen doesn't get black. So we're back with that. Okay. So the ISO day-ahead market opens 7 days before the trade date, and then at 10 a.m. the day before, the market closes. So it's about 10:10 this morning. So about 10 minutes ago, the market for tomorrow closed, and then we will run the market. And about 1 o'clock today, those market results will be available to participants. So they'll receive their day-ahead schedules, the bids that have been awarded, and then at that time, when the day-ahead market results are published, that opens the real-time market. And so from that point on until 75 minutes before the trade hour, the real-time market is open, where you can submit new and revised bids for each hour of the next operating day. And then those market results that I talked about, when those are published, they're available to market participants, including pricing. And those are published on OASIS and also some of our internal reporting applications. Next slide, please. So here we have an example of what clears in the integrated forward market. And I don't know, Tegan, if the animation will work on these slides, but there should be two words that will pop up. There we go, total clear demand, and then on the left hand, the market clearing price. So in the day ahead, we take all of the bids for supply and all of the bids for demand, and those are plotted along bid curves. The point or the intersection where those two curves cross is called the market clearing price or the total clear demand. So based on that intersection of where those two points cross, we have the total cleared demand for each hour of the coming day. So the day ahead market runs for all 24 hours of the following day. There is a market clearing price for energy that is set for each hour of that day. Next slide, please. So you've heard us refer to LMP, or locational marginal pricing. So that energy component becomes the very first piece of this puzzle here. So we're looking at the market clearing price. That is the market clearing price for energy. And then that, added together with congestion and losses, becomes the locational marginal price. There was a question in the room?
Yeah, will you cover at some point how self-scheduling fits into the whole situation?
I didn't plan on covering self-schedules. Did we want to talk about that when we get...
I think the assumption in our example.
So. At the end?
Yeah.
We have an example in our settlements. In our settlements analysis at the very end that has a self-schedule in it. I'm not sure if that will help you, but we kind of show how CRRs are providing a hedge. I don't want to say wait until the very end, but that's where that's talked about. So if that doesn't answer your question at that point, then we can maybe go into a little bit more detail then. Okay, so there is a locational marginal price that's set in the day-ahead market. It sets an hourly LMP for each price node in the system. And then in real time, we set 15-minute and 5-minute LMPs. And we have an asterisk on the slide here. For those of you familiar with the energy imbalance market, there's also a greenhouse gas component as a piece of the locational marginal price. So it's energy, congestion, and losses. And for the EIM folks, there's also the possibility of a greenhouse gas adder. Next slide, please, Tegan. So then in real time, we're looking at the real-time market timeline here. In real time, we're fine-tuning the flow of electricity to follow fluctuations in supply and demand. So in real time, we're looking as many as 5 hours ahead, and we're looking at what the conditions have been forecast, what supply we anticipate will be needed, and we're committing any extra power at that point. As I mentioned, 75 minutes before the top of the hour, the real-time market closes. Here on the slide, it's listed as an hour and 15 minutes ahead of the hour. So from 3 o'clock the day before, when the day-ahead market results are published, up until 75 minutes before the top of the hour, you have the opportunity to bid for that specific hourly interval. And then in the 15 minutes ahead of a specific time interval, we are starting up and shutting down resources and also procuring additional ancillary services. So ancillary services are other products used for reliability. And then in the 5-minute intervals is when we are dispatching generation, and there will also be a 5-minute price along with that. Next slide, please. So that's a really high-level example or explanation of what the day-ahead market and the real-time market timeline looks like. We do have, you know, outside of this session here, which is really focused on CRRs, if you are interested in learning more about the day-ahead market, more about the real-time market, or more about the energy imbalance market, we do have a number of computer-based training modules that you can go through on the California ISO website, and, you know, that will give you some more information. We do also have classes that we hold in person in Folsom, California, that take you through information about the day ahead and the real-time market in our introduction to ISO markets. So there's information on the web if you'd like more information about the ISO market. There's also in-person classes. I see a couple familiar faces here of folks that I've seen in those classes before. So there is other information out there on how the market works. Now we're going to kind of dive into CRRs and how they fit in. We'll go through a couple of definitions first just to form an understanding for those of you that may not be familiar with what CRRs are. A CRR is a financial instrument that enables its holder to manage variability in congestion costs that occur under a congestion management protocol in a standard energy market. CRRs are acquired by qualified entities primarily for the purpose of offsetting costs associated with this day-ahead congestion costs. When CRRs are acquired, the ISO will calculate the estimated value of the CRR to determine if any additional collateral is needed. We call this the CRR credit holding requirement. As I mentioned, I promised we wouldn't go through slides and slides of calculations, but I do have in the reference section at the end of this presentation, I do have a section there on the CRR credit holding requirement for those of you that are interested in knowing what those actual calculations are. Those are there for you in the reference section. Next slide, please, Tegan. So we have a process with CRRs where we allocate or give to load-serving entities, CRRs, or we auction off. In other words, those folks have to pay for those CRR rights. With the allocation, CRRs are allocated to entities that provide for the upkeep of the transmission system, and these are provided at no cost. These are provided to internal load-serving entities, or LSEs, out-of-balancing authority area, LSEs, and there are some requirements with that that we'll walk through, or to project sponsors of merchant transmission facilities. As far as the auction is concerned, the CRR auction is available to candidate CRR holders subject to their creditworthiness requirements. So basically in the auction, you have to pay for the rights that you are getting. With the allocation, these are given to the load-serving entities at no cost. Next slide, please. The way CRRs are defined, there are a number of different ways to categorize them. We have CRR terms. These can be either options or obligations, and we'll walk through what those are. And they are also allocated or given out in the form of an auction to basically the highest bidder. With the life term, they can be either a one-month or a one-season CRR. We also have a long-term allocation process that extends that seasonal CRR that is awarded in the annual auction an additional 9 years, so that would provide a total of a 10-year hedge with that specific CRR. There are 4 calendar seasons that correspond with the 4 quarters of the calendar year. With regard to time of use, this could be either off-peak or on-peak CRRs. And then we have a megawatt quantity. So this is the volume of congestion revenue rights that are either allocated or purchased. For example, if you have 1 megawatt of CRRs for the term of January 2017, and it's an on-peak time of use CRR, this means that you have 1 megawatt of CRRs during each of the 400 peak hours for that specific month. And then we have CRRs defined by sink and a source. So this could be an individual node, a load aggregation point, which is a collection of price nodes, or it could be a group of nodes. This can be sink generators, interties, trading hubs. Next slide, please. So with CRRs, there's either an obligation or an option, and we'll walk through the differences here. With the CRR obligation, this entitles CRR holders to a payment if congestion is in the same direction as the CRR and requires a charge if congestion is in the opposite direction of the CRR. A CRR obligation is acquired either via allocation or via the auction process. For the CRR options, this entitles the CRR holder to a payment if congestion is in the same direction as the CRR, but requires no payment if the congestion is in the opposite direction of the CRR. The options are only available to project sponsors of a merchant transmission facility that do not elect some form of regulatory cost recovery or converted merchant transmission facilities as another option. Next slide, please.
On that last slide, did I read that right? It says if you have a CRR obligation.
Is your mic on?
Oh.
So maybe you'll get into this a little bit later, but in that last slide, did I read that right? That's saying that if you hold a CRR, you can also be responsible to pay for something as opposed to just being paid? Okay.
That is correct.
Well, there'll be more on that later.
Do we have more on that?
Yeah, we can talk about more.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we'll walk through. When we get to the allocation process, we can stop and address any subsequent questions that haven't been fully vetted on the slides for you. Yeah. So for the CRR terms, when we're talking about seasons, they're defined on a quarterly basis. Season 1, 2, 3, and 4 correspond with the 4 seasons of the calendar year. We also have long-term CRRs that extend, as I mentioned, 9 years after the annual term for a total of 10 years, and this would be for an allocation only. And then if you have a CRR for a specific month, those are the actual calendar months, January, February, et cetera. Next slide, please. With regard to the time of use definition, I mentioned that there was an on-peak and an off-peak period. This definition that we're using is consistent with what the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, or WECC, and the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, what they consider to be off-peak and on-peak hours. So those definitions are for on-peak, they consist of the hours from 6 a.m., or hour ending 7, to 10 p.m., or hour ending 22, for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, assuming that these days are not holidays. Next slide, please. And then with the off-peak period, this consists of the hours from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all 24 hours for days that are Sundays or holidays. And the holidays are specific holidays on the calendar, so New Year's Day, Memorial Day, Independence Day, Labor Day, Thanksgiving, and Christmas. And if the holiday happens to fall on a Sunday, then the first following Monday is treated as if it were a Sunday, meaning that all hours for that day would be considered off-peak. Next slide, please. As we mentioned before, CRRs are financial rights. So a market participant does not need a CRR in order to bid into the day-ahead market. And if a market participant has a CRR and bids in energy, the energy bid does not need to be consistent with the CRR in terms of sink or source, location, or the megawatt quantity. And then on the flip side, a market participant does not need to bid to hold a CRR. So you can have one or the other or both, but they don't have to be related to each other. And for the CRR, this only settles on the marginal cost of congestion, or MCC. When you saw that chart with the three bubbles for the locational marginal price, there was energy, congestion, and losses. The marginal cost of congestion is what we mean by that little congestion bubble. So it only settles on the MCC, or the marginal cost of congestion, of the day-ahead locational marginal price for each respective hour. So CRRs are something that also incentivize the participation of load in day ahead because they don't have this CRR hedge when we get to real time. Next slide, please. Now, in order to participate in the CRR process, whether it is the allocation or the auction, a person must register as a candidate CRR holder in order to participate. You do not need to be a scheduling coordinator to hold CRRs. Scheduling coordinators are those folks who work with the ISO and actually schedule or bid into the market. You don't have to be a scheduling coordinator to hold a CRR, but you do have to go through a registration process that is somewhat similar to registering to becoming a scheduling coordinator. The process for registering takes about 60 days to complete. And in the reference section at the back of the presentation, I've included a couple of slides that go into further detail about the registration process, who you need to contact, what you need to do, what forms you need to fill out. All of that is included at the end of the presentation as well. Next slide, please. So we talked at a high level just defining some terms. What are CRRs? Now we're going to walk through the different processes. We have the CRR allocation process and the auction process, and we're going to start off first with the timeline for this. Next slide, please. So we're looking at this diagram here, and it may be harder to see on the projector, but if you have it in front of you, we're going to walk through first just looking at what the timeline looks visually, and then we're going to have a couple of slides that have words that explain this chart. So I wanted to point out some key things so that when we go through the words part of it, you can tie that back to the visual here. So if we're looking at this presentation, and I'll use my mouse for those of you that are in the room, if we look at the far left of the slide, we're looking at TA1 and TLT1. This is basically the first tiers for the annual and the long-term process. And these hash marks along the line, those first four marks, correspond to the last 4 months of a year. So if we're looking for the you are here part on the map, we're before that very beginning part, that September, October, and November and December of this year. If we were looking at this, if we were running this for 2017. So September, October, November, and December, about 4 months before the beginning of 2017, we start running these annual processes. And there are some notes on the next slide that explain that a little bit more in detail, but that's where we start off. So 4 months before the start of the year, we're running the annual process for that year. At the end of the annual process, we mentioned that the long-term CRRs can also be extended for 9 additional years for a full 10-year hedge, so we'll explain a little bit of how that works. And then if we look at the seasonal auctions, you can see that there's season 1, 2, 3, and 4. And about a month before that begins is when we start running the processes for that piece of it. So you can see TM1 and TM2 show you that we're running about a month before the season. Is that
for the month.
Is that 1 month before the season, Jim, or 2?
Yeah, so the season is done with the annual process.
The seasons are done with the annual process. Okay, thank you for clarifying that. So the annual process produces the seasonal CRRs. And then when we're doing the monthly CRRs, we run that process about a month before each month. So if we're looking at this slide here, the first four hash marks are September, October, November, December of 2016. And then you can see that we have the year broken up into quarters. So you'll see the first quarter or season separated by the larger, bolder lines. And then you can see that as we're getting toward the end of 2017, we start running the annual process again for the following year. So that's just kind of visually what we're going to be talking about over the next couple of slides. Next slide, please. So during the annual process, 75% of the full network model capacity will be made available during that annual process. I mentioned the first two lines on the chart. That was the annual and the long-term process. So approximately 4 months before the start of that CRR year, the annual allocation or auction process will begin, and that produces seasonal or time-of-use CRRs for those four seasons of that year. And then the long-term tier of the annual allocation process produces seasonal or long-term CRRs that are allocated for a total duration of 10 years. So 1 year from the annual allocation and then a 9-year extension through the long-term tier. So that's how that works. Next slide, please. And then as I mentioned, with the annual process, when you were looking at that chart there, about 4 months before the end of the year, we're starting to work on the following CRR year. So we do the annual allocation process all over again, producing additional seasonal or time-of-use CRRs for those four seasons, and also producing long-term CRRs. Now, there's a concept or a phrase that we use when we're talking about the CRR processes, or the auction and the allocation, and we call it that, or we say they're processed simultaneously. So what does that mean? It means that when all four seasonal Tier 1 allocation markets are processed, they're all opened for nomination submission, and then all four are then closed for nomination submission at the same time. And nomination submission is a request for an allocation. So as I mentioned, with the allocation, we give at no charge specific CRRs, but there is a process for the load-serving entity to actually request a quantity. And we'll talk about how that works, but that's what we mean by nomination submission. So all four seasonal tiers open and then close simultaneously. Next slide, please. After this, the ISO then runs what we call the simultaneous feasibility test. This is a process for each seasonal tier one. So there is an SFT, or a simultaneous feasibility test, for the on-peak period, and then a simultaneous feasibility test for the off-peak period for each one of those seasons. We post all of these market results at the same time. They're posted to the CRR Market User Interface application and also to OASIS. So this is public information. You can view the market results of the CRR auctions and allocations on OASIS, which is our open access same-time information system, also accessible from the ISO website. Next slide, please. So in the design for, oh, question.
What exactly is the feasibility test testing?
I will tell you that in just a moment.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'll say it a few times, and I'll say, I know I've said this a few times, but let's talk about what that is. So it's about one or two slides away. Yes.
So is the feasibility interface on?
No. Sounds like it might be on.
Okay. So is the feasibility actually 4 months out then?
Yeah, good question. So the timing of this thing is we're actually running the annual process about 4 months for the first season, so we're running it in September, October timeframe for season one, but we're also doing season two, season three, season four, so you can be up to 14, 15 months out for the last season. So it's all done at that same time, though. So it's all done in the summer, basically, of 2016. We're running the entire 2017 process.
So as we put this together, the ISO market design for CRRs was focused on the allocation process as opposed to just an auction-only system. So the load-serving entities participate in the allocation first. There are long-term allocation of CRRs for a 10-year period at 60% of system capacity. Then there is the annual process, and there's three tiers with that at 75% of system capacity. And then when we get down to the monthly process, there's two tiers for monthly And this is where we're doing 100% of system capacity with planned outages modeled. Next slide, please. So I mentioned outages. So with the annual process, we assume that all lines are in service unless we know of a long-term outage prior to the time we're running the annual process. So everything is considered to be in service unless we're aware of a long-term outage, and then we will put that into the model when we're running that process. When we get down to the monthly processes, we have all of the monthly planned outages factored into the model as well. And then after each allocation process, there is an auction for the remaining capacity subject to the simultaneous feasibility test. And that is the annual and a monthly process as well. Next slide, please. I think we're getting to the simultaneous feasibility test. Yes, here we are. Here we are. Okay. So the simultaneous feasibility test. We have a couple of slides to kind of walk through this. There is a lot more information in our business practice manuals, many, many pages of calculations, but we're going to at a high level kind of discuss what this looks like. Next slide, please. So the purpose of the simultaneous feasibility test is to award CRRs based on the optimization formula and also to ensure revenue adequacy. So the idea behind the simultaneous feasibility test is to take the CRR source location, the CRR sink location, and the megawatt quantity of the CRR nomination, a nomination is an allocation, or the CRR bid that comes from the auction, and apply these to the full network model as if they were generators and loads. I did want to point out here, when we say generators and loads, you could probably more technically accurately refer to this as injections and withdrawals on the system, but the idea is that we're putting them onto the full network model as if they were actual generation and loads. The full network model that we're using for the CRR auction is similar to the full network model that we actually use in the day-ahead market. So the topology is the same. We have the constraint limits modeled. When we're talking about constraint limits, I mean things like thermal line limits, branch groups, nomograms, your interfaces, so your Palo Verdes, your Malins, and contingencies. So all of that information is factored into the CRR model or the FNM model that we use while we're running this simultaneous feasibility test. Next slide, please. There are also other things that we model. There's two basic types of transmission rights that the ISO models through the CRR process. The first would be transmission ownership rights. Now, these are transmission that the ISO does not have any rights to, so this would be non-PTO transmission. And we also model existing transmission contracts. This would be contractual rights to capacity that is held by the PTOs prior to joining the ISO. So that is put into a different category. And these rights are defined through the transmission rights, transmission curtailment procedures, which I believe we have spelled out in detail in the BPMs as well. And I keep mentioning this because we're trying to keep this high level for you, but there's pages and pages of calculations that you can go through if you want to start plugging in numbers and figuring out the math. But I feel like math as a group project is really not the most appropriate use of our time when we're all together here in the room. Next slide, please. So when the ISO is modeling these rights, the purpose or the intent is to remove capacity, which has a perfect hedge, so that CRRs are not allocated or auctioned on that specific capacity. So this would be exempt from all ISO congestion charges if their schedules are within their rights or of the perfect hedge. We also have an example at the end of this presentation to walk you through how CRRs provide a perfect hedge. With these specific rights modeled, the ISO actually holds these CRRs, not the rights holder. Next slide, please. So get more about the simultaneous feasibility test. The CRR FNM, or the full network model that we use when we're running the simultaneous feasibility test, is a DC model, such that 1 megawatt of injection equates to 1 megawatt of withdrawal. So here we're saying there are no transmission losses or reactive power actually modeled in the system. I do want to mention that we do adjust the limits for absence of losses at 2% and reactive power at 3%. So there is a factor that's put in there, but they don't model each specific loss on each individual line. It kind of applies across the board, this factor, to adjust for that. And the ISO provides the market participants with access to the full network model that is used in the CRR process to assist with your own analysis. So there is a non-disclosure agreement that you can fill out. It's required to obtain access to that, but this is not something that we want to keep a secret, what the model looks like and how it works. So you can have access to the CRR full network model through the use of the non-disclosure agreement. There's some information in the reference section on how to apply for that and how to get that. And the purpose behind the simultaneous feasibility test is to make sure that the system is solving feasibly, that the solution is feasible. If infeasibility occurs, meaning that all nominations or bids cannot clear simultaneously, then we have a process that we apply that reduces the nomination or bid megawatt quantities until we achieve that feasibility. And really the purpose here is, you know, we're basing this on the actual full network model, so we want it to be as accurate as possible. Next slide, please. So we have a couple more slides on simultaneous feasibility tests, and then we'll take a pause for any lingering questions and any questions from folks on the phone over what we've covered, because we've kind of churned through a lot of material. And I forgot to move my mouse again. Okay, our screen is back. So with the simultaneous feasibility test, there is an optimization formula that is used in both the CRR allocation and CRR auction process. You can see there's a typo there where I typed optimization formulation. That should just be formula. My apologies. So we're looking at the topology, and the constraints are the same when we're running the formula. The objective function is slightly different in each. With the objective function, I asked Jim, can you explain what you mean by that in just English? What do you mean by objective function? And he said, that's how the software decides who gets what megawatts. So that's pretty straightforward. So how we do that in the allocation is slightly different from how we do that in the auction, or not slightly different, but different. In the allocation, the objective function utilizes what we call weighted least squares, or WLS, weighted least squares, another acronym for you. So this effectively means that allocation entities have the same bid on their nomination, and they share in the allocation of the available capacity. For example, if we have two load-serving entities that are bidding from A to B for 10 megawatts each, and there happens to be a constraint that limits flow to 5 megawatts, then each of those two LSEs would receive 2.5 megawatts. So they have the ability to have an equal share of the capacity that's available. That's a simplified example, obviously, because I say we just had two, but if you can extrapolate that out to a grander scale, you can see that each entity will have the same opportunity for the capacity that's available on that line. And then, of course, with the CRR auction, the objective function is to maximize the bid-based value of the awarded CRRs. So basically, essentially, the highest bid on those will win. Next slide, please. Okay, so we're going to pause here. We talked about, at a high level, defining what CRRs are. We talked a little bit about the timeline and the simultaneous feasibility test. Next up is to talk about the allocation process and then the auction process. But I wanted to pause for a moment. Number one, to check on the pacing. How are we doing on pace? Am I going too fast, too slow? Following along so far? Okay. Does anybody, first we'll take questions from the folks in the room. Does anybody in the room have any questions at this point?
Can you talk a little bit more about the simultaneous feasibility test with regards to the load-serving entities and the allocation, and just what happens if when you run the SFT, if there's not enough to allocate to the load-serving entity for what they actually need? Does that imply they can't serve their load, or is it, you know,
what's behind that? Jim, can you take that for me?
Yeah, that's actually a good question, because it leads into the key behind the CR process is that what we do in the CR market correlates to what the day-ahead market is doing. But the reality is we're not doing optimization of dispatch and stuff like that in the CR. All we're doing is we're saying we have a certain bucket of capacity that we can use based on the model and the constraints and stuff. So if you don't get awarded the CR, let's say you request 10 megawatts and that's what you're going to schedule, you're going to get awarded 7 or 6 megawatts or whatever. You still can schedule whatever you want in the day-ahead market. It's just a matter of how much of the hedge are you going to get for the CR. And where you see this, and we've done several studies over the years, basically we get LSEs that are requesting 10 megawatts as 100% of their load. Well, the reality is you don't always have 10 megawatts that you're scheduling every hour, but the CRs are there for every hour on peak, for every hour off peak. So over time, if you get a 75-80% award on your nominations, that is tended to be sufficient from a hedging standpoint to provide enough revenue back to you to cover the load that's actually being scheduled. So to answer the question directly, CRs have nothing to do with the physical scheduling, meaning it does not restrict physical scheduling at all. It's just a matter of how much hedge are you getting when you do make that physical schedule.
Any follow-up questions in the room? Tegan, how about our folks on the phone? Do we have any questions from folks on the phone?
Just a quick reminder, if you'd like to, please dial pound on your telephone number. I'm not showing any questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Can you go ahead and advance the next slide, please? So we're going to talk first about the allocation process. So in order to participate in the allocation process, I feel like the mic volume has gotten, maybe, is this better? I felt like there was some feedback. Let me restart and we'll see how that goes. You need to be classified as one of the following, either a load serving entity or an LSE, which includes entities serving load within the ISO control area and also metered subsystems. Metered subsystems are sub-control areas inside of a balancing authority area. You also can be what is called an out-of-balancing authority area load-serving entity. Jim calls these the OBALZs. So that just rolls off your tongue. So if you are an OBALZ, this includes load external to the ISO balancing authority area being served with internally owned or contracted generation that is subject to congestion on the ISO-controlled grid. They're subject to other conditions, such as prepayment of wheeling access charge. Can we move to the next slide, please? And then we have the merchant transmission. Now, you'll be eligible for a merchant transmission CRR only if the entity has turned over the qualifying facilities to the ISO and has elected not to recover cost of its investments through a regulated cost of recovery or through a regulated cost recovery mechanism. The duration of this merchant transmission CRR will be 30 years or the pre-specified intended life of that specific facility. Next slide, please. So we calculate eligible quantities for the allocation participants. So once a candidate CRR holder has registered and becomes eligible to participate in the CRR allocation process, the ISO requires them to submit either historical or forecast load data. We use this load data to determine either the seasonal CRR eligible quantity or the monthly CRR eligible quantity, respectively. For entities that have load that fluctuates based on hydrological conditions, the monthly data that they provide to the ISO can either be forecast data or it can be historical data. Next slide, please. So some more specifications regarding the obalvies. So for these folks, before calculating the eligible quantity for an obalvie, it must demonstrate eligibility to participate in the CRR allocation by doing the following. So we need to, they need to show legitimate need by demonstrating that the entity holds an existing contract with or owns generation external to the ISO control area. They must prepay the appropriate wheeling access charge based on the amount of CRRs being nominated. They also need to confirm that the external load for which the CRRs are being nominated is not served under either transmission ownership rights or existing transmission contract rights and is exposed to the ISO congestion charges. All CRR nominations in all CRR years must be source verified. So that's the qualifications or the criteria for the obalvie process. Next slide, please. So we have another chart to walk through. We'll take a look at the chart first, and then there'll be some slides where we discuss the process. The main thing I wanted to do is just kind of point out for you how to read this chart. If we look on the far right side, we have CRR participants that are interacting through what we call our market user interface. So there's an application that the CRR participants, either in the allocation or in the auction, uses. For the priority nomination process, now we're looking at the arrow that goes from that one large box over to the processes on the left side, and that shows historic load data. So we're requesting historic load data that gets fed into the process, and then from that, we provide back to the participant, you can see the other arrow going back, the eligible quantity of CRRs that may be requested. So you submit historic load data. Then you get back the quantity of CRRs that may be requested. And then, as you can see, there's a number of tiers where you have various iterations of this nomination process. So you will request a certain quantity of CRRs, and then you will receive cleared CRRs from that process and then move through the tiers. And I took some notes when Jim and I were talking about this. The annual process starts in September and ends in November. Each one of these specific tiers that you see broken out here, from open to close of posting of results, is roughly 1.5 weeks, and then the next tier opens up. So a couple-week period of time as we go through each one of these tiers. And we also have, there are, of course, details and special rules for the running of each one of the tiers that we're not going to wade through, but you can look to the business practice manual for deeper information on how each one of those tiers is run. But basically, you can see along the left side, you'll see a separate simultaneous feasibility test will be run for each time of use. You can see that for Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, and the auction, the full network model capacity is scaled to 75%. Whereas the long-term tier is scaled to 60%. And we heard those numbers before, but that's how they kind of play out on the chart. Go ahead and move to the next slide, please.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
What determines the historic load data?
So depend upon, and again, how everybody gets set up. Right now, currently, the way the ISO is set up, everybody serves load to what we call default LAP locations. So they're aggregated load locations. So it's based on the historical load for each of those DLAP locations.
Does that answer it or no?
Is that seasonally varied or how do you, the LAP could be different from the peak of ISO, so can you explain?
Everybody, that's a good point. Every LSE will actually have different historical load, different non-coincident peaks, right? And it's basically for the annual process, there's going to be a number done for season one on peak, season two on off peak, on and off peak. So you get basically 8 numbers for the annual process. And then when you go down to the monthly, then we start drilling down even a little bit more granular than that. But the gentleman over here, did that look like you had another question?
Yeah, well, I was just kind of curious. So even if a load-serving entity is invested in the transmission facilities, they're limited, their CRR allocation is limited to their load in any given season?
Correct.
So they don't they've invested in the facilities, they don't get, like, counterflow CRR rights up to a certain level.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Now, and basically, the way that was driven, at least for the how the market that is decided right now, is it was based on historical load for the annual process and then forecasted load for the monthly. So the monthly is where you see the true up. But, yeah, there's nothing, no tie-in to the actual amount of payment you might be making through tax charges or anything of that nature.
Okay.
Did I see another question? Okay, moving back to the slides. So for the annual tiered process, for the annual allocation process, Tier 1 is what we call the priority nomination process. The priority nomination process is intended to allow load-serving entities to re-nominate annually certain CRRs that are part of a base loading portfolio. So a request for a priority nomination process would be for a resource that you're going to be using all the time. The only time it's not in use is if it's offline for maintenance. So those are the kind of ones that would fall into this category. If entities that did not participate or did not receive any CRRs through the annual allocation process are not eligible to participate in this priority nomination process. Next slide, please. So during this priority nomination process, a load-serving entity, or an OBALZI, may make nominations up to the lesser of either two-thirds of its seasonal CRR-eligible quantity or the total quantity of seasonal CRRs allocated to that LSE in the previous annual CRR allocation. Next slide, please. In this priority nomination process, CRR nominations are all signature validated, meaning that the CRR source sync pairs have to have been allocated in the immediately previous annual CRR allocation process and cannot exceed the megawatt amounts that were allocated. In the priority nomination process, CRR nominations with trading hubs as a source are allowed. However, CRR nominations with the sublap as a sink are not allowed. So we'll maybe after we go through this process take any questions with regard to what that means specifically or why that's something that we're pointing out. Next slide, please. So after the priority nomination process, the long-term tier begins and is limited to a maximum of 50% of its adjusted load metrics. Minus the quantity of previously allocated long-term CRRs that are valid for that year. And again, in this process, they're all signature validated, meaning the CRR source sync pairs have to have been allocated in that immediately previous priority nomination process and can't exceed that megawatt amount that was allocated. Next slide, please. So we're going to kind of walk through the tiers. So Tier 2 is limited to two-thirds of its seasonal CRR-eligible quantity for each season, time of use, and CRR sync. And now I'm going to just say a lot of words. Minus the quantity of CRRs allocated either to that LSE or OBALZI in Tier 1. Long-term CRRs previously allocated that are valid for the CRR term currently being allocated, and the net megawatt amount of long-term load migrations, CRRs, assigned to the load-serving entity that are valid for the term currently being allocated. We have a couple of slides coming up that will explain to you what we mean by load migration, if that's something that you're thinking, what does that mean? We'll talk about that. CRR nominations with the trading hub as a source are allowed. And sublaps or sub-load aggregation point with will be eligible CRR sinks provided that that sublap is within the nominating entity's default lap. So a load aggregation point is a collection of price nodes in a specific area or a default area. And then that area can be further broken down to, did you say these were buses or what did you say the...
The sublaps are typically separated by transmission constraints. So the concept for the CRs is that you want to get the hedge for how you're scheduling your load. your load is going to be valued based on the differential between the shadow prices of those constraints. So if you have, and again, I apologize, I don't know your guys' areas, but if you have a particular DLAP area that maybe has five different major transmission constraints within it, you might have five sublaps, because that then breaks down that price. It breaks down the price into the regions that don't have any transmission constraints within them. Because what you want to do is you want to get that transfer price going across to that constraint. So the sublaps will be within the bigger area, but they'll be separated by the transmission constraints of the area. Does that make sense?
Thanks, Jim. Next slide, please. So we have this other process. After Tier 2 of the annual allocation process, or after Tier 2 of the annual allocation, a process is performed to set aside 50% of the residual import capacity on the interfaces, or the interties. This is referred to as the set-aside process. The set-aside amounts are made public prior to the opening of the Tier 3 of the annual allocation. For example, if an interface or an intertie has an import limit of 100 megawatts and 60 megawatts is taken up by previously awarded CRRs, then there is a residual import amount of 40 megawatts, of which 20 would be then set aside. So 50% of that is set aside. This 20 megawatts would reduce the import limit going into Tier 3, leaving a limit of 80 megawatts, and the auction limit would be increased back to the original 100 megawatts. And really the point here is to have some capacity available at the interties that would be available for the auction participants. So it's setting aside some of this capacity for the auction. Next slide, please. So more about annual. A load serving entity in Tier 3 is limited to 100% of its seasonal CRR eligible quantity for each season, time of use, and CRR sink minus the quantity of, and these are the next few bullets, any Tier 1 and 2 allocated CRRs, long-term CRRs previously allocated that are valid for the CRR term that is currently being allocated, and the net megawatt amount of long-term load migration CRRs assigned to the LSE that are valid for that term that's currently being allocated. CRR nominations with the trading hub as a source are allowed, and sublaps, these subload aggregation points, will be eligible CRR sinks, provided that those sublaps are located within the nominating entity's default lap. Next slide, please. So now we're going to talk about monthly. All of that was annual conversation. So in the monthly timeline, we have 100% of the full network model capacity being made available after accounting for any adjustments for outages or for D-rates. Approximately 6 weeks before the start of any month, the CRR monthly process begins, which produces monthly time-of-use CRRs for that specific month. For each monthly process, there are typically four different releases of the full network model, version 0, 1, 2, and 3. You can see the description of those spelled out on the slides here. And I wanted to point out again that you have access to this CRR full network model information. Once you sign the non-disclosure agreement and go through that process, you would have the ability to have that information for your own analysis during these processes. And then we have a monthly process that we illustrate on the following slide in the monthly process figure. Can we move to the next slide, please? So this is the monthly process. So the annual process was stretched out quite wide, and then we had a number of different tiers going on. Here in the monthly process, there are two tiers for the allocation and then one auction process. So we have still on the far right of this diagram, the CRR participants are providing information through the market user interface. So they're still providing forecast load data. That goes into Tier 1 for the allocation. And then they receive back the eligible quantity of CRRs that they may request. They request that by submitting a nomination, and then they receive back the cleared value of the CRRs. Then there's a second tier for that process, and then we go to the auction for the remaining capacity. And again, pointing out on the side of the slide, showing vertically, we see that the capacity at 100% minus any outages or derates. So as we're getting closer to the month, we basically we're offering up the 100% of the capacity that's available. Next slide, please. So here in our monthly process, there is not a priority nomination process in this monthly allocation. In Tier 1 of the monthly allocation, load-serving entities and OBALSIs can nominate up to 100% of the difference between its monthly CRR-eligible quantity and the total of any seasonal CRRs allocated in the annual CRR allocation and any holdings of long-term CRRs that are valid for the month and time of use of the CRRs being nominated. In this monthly process, trading hubs are allowed as sources, and sublats, subload aggregation points, will be eligible CRR sinks, provided that the sublap is within the nominating entity's default lap. Next slide, please. Jim has a comment he'd like to share.
Just to let you guys know, you know, we didn't do a whole bunch of tiers just because we wanted to have a bunch of back and forth. There was an intent behind it. And the intent for specifically, you'll notice it's only in the allocation process that we have that. The intent being that you get to see what your results are. You get to see what binding constraints are from tier to tier. So what you do is you make your nominations based on what you feel is going to get the, is going to best hedge what you're scheduling as an LSE, and then you get to see that, oh, there's binding constraints based on what everybody else's nominations have done, what the simultaneous feasibility test pulls out and says there's now constraints in an area that you might have gotten only half of what you wanted. So then it gives you that opportunity to go ahead and make an election to go somewhere else to hedge another portion of the load. So the iterative nature of the allocation is kind of important from the standpoint of why we also try to get people to really get access to that NDA data so that you can see what those constraints are so that you aren't blindly just not renominating stuff that is just going to bind again and you're not going to get any awards. So it gives you that ability to do that. So that's, again, the focus behind that tiered structure is to get that back and forth nature of the exchange. Okay?
So it's a process that it's an educated process where you're provided, you do your initial nominations and you receive information, you figure out what you have left, and then you have opportunity to obtain more CRRs many different times through the annual and the monthly process. Thank you, Jim. I don't recall if I,
sorry,
I don't know if I read the slide yet, no. So I'm just going to talk about it. So in Tier 2 of the monthly allocation, load-serving entities and OBALSIs can nominate up to 100%, now I feel like I did say these words, 100% of the difference between its monthly CRR-eligible quantity and the total of any seasonal CRRs allocated in the annual CRR allocation and any holdings of long-term CRRs that are valid for the month and time of use of that CRR being nominated minus the number of the monthly CRRs allocated in Tier 1. Trading hubs are allowed as a source, and sublaps will be eligible CRR sinks, provided that the sublap is within the entity's default lap. Next slide, please. And just like we have in the annual process, after Tier 1 of the monthly allocation is run, a process is performed to set aside 50% of the residual import capacity on the interfaces, which is referred to as a set-aside process. And again, these amounts are made public prior to the opening of Tier 2 of the monthly allocation. Next slide, please. All right, so that was the CRR allocation process. Let's take a break here and kind of have that information digest in our heads. Think for a moment if you have any questions about the CRR allocation process, about what we've talked about, the simultaneous feasibility test. Any questions from folks in the room? And folks on the phone who are listening, if you can collect your thoughts and bring up any questions, now would be a good time for that as well. And for those of you here in person, there are snacks in the back of the room. Please enjoy.
Just a quick question on the allocation to the auction group. It says here that they're taking some of the capacity from the interfaces, and I think you said also that's the inner ties. Does that result in somebody who's importing resources to serve load that there's a more likelihood that they're not going to get enough CRRs to serve or to hedge their load? And does that also happen with internal CRR allocations as well, or is that only just to the interfaces that are external?
Yeah, that's actually a good question, because the intent behind that whole set-aside process was kind of a compromise with the allocation and auction, but if you look at when it's held, when the set-aside is done, the allocation participants have already had their shot at it, so to speak. So the intent was, you know what, the important sources have already been requested at that point in time and allocated out. If there's anything left at that point in time, then there's a set-aside done. But the other part that kind of gets lost in this translation, and I don't know how deep we want to go into this, but when you set aside capacity at a tie, all that does is I kind of correlate it to that's kind of like getting to the door. It doesn't mean that if you do a source at that location, that if you go into the ISO or into the load serving area, that it's going to clear every constraint internal. And I think that goes to your next question was, we don't set aside internal constraints. It was only the interfaces, and that was it.
Tegan, do we have any questions from the folks listening on the phone?
Not at this time. And to do a question style pound.
Okay. So we're going to, for the folks that are in the room, do we want to do a quick stretch break and then come back to auction? Would that be? So we're going to take a break, or folks on the phone, we're going to take a break for about 5 to 7 minutes and come back in just a few and dive into the auction. Let those thoughts and the information germinate a little bit, and then we'll be right back. Okay, folks, we're going to go ahead and reconvene and get started. As you can imagine, when we take a break, there's some questions that start to get asked, so I thought I would give the mic over to Jim for a few minutes so he could go through some additional explanation and also cover some of the things that we've discussed here in the room for the benefit of everybody. So, Jim, it's your show.
Thank you. And just so, be perfectly clear, we're not here to sell anything. We're here to kind of get information out, because everybody has a different business model that they have to determine what is going to work best for. What we want to do is give you at least what the current market that we have is being, how it's being done and how it's being run. And it, you know, just during the break, I had several people come up and just asking questions that are very relevant to what the discussion should be, and that is, how does this really relate to my business? How is this going to benefit me? And so, and again, I apologize, because part of this is I'm not making maybe a very good explanation of stuff, or I'm not getting into the details enough to give you guys enough information. So if you guys don't feel like you're understanding this stuff, or if there's something that's not coming across, please ask questions.
Just keep asking him.
Yeah.
Just keep asking.
And it'll eventually come across. But one of the questions Bill had asked is we were talking about, and again, this is because I wasn't explaining it properly. When we talk about the allocation, and it'll go back to your question a little bit more, too, about this whole concern about charges and revenue stream. When the allocation is set up, the intent is that you can't just go out and request whatever you want. The intent is that we are trying to get you to request the way that you're going to serve your load. So when we set up these, we talk about historical load, we talk about forecast load, it's based on how your load has been served in the past for historical purposes and how it's going to be served in the future. So when we talk about, and this is where you guys will all get together and decide, you guys know the system way better than I do on your side, how is it best to set up this model? Is it do you have a completely open system where there are no constraints within these huge areas to where, you know what, you just have one VLAP and you can serve all your load? Because the concern that CRRs are trying to resolve is that if you have an area that has no constraints, then you have no congestion price differentials. So that means that you're not exposed to any congestion. The concern that you're going to have, or you should have if you're serving your load, is how are you going to hedge yourself when that risk does pop up? So you're going to be concerned about areas that have physical transmission constraints that the market is enforcing, and by enforcing those constraints, you create shadow prices, you create price differentials. And again, my explanation probably was not real well provided, but when we talked about the sublaps, it is driven off of the physical constraints on the system. So if you have this big region, and I don't even want to give names because I don't know what the areas are, but let me use PG&E as an example. We have a particular area, Humboldt region, that is very transmission constrained, meaning there is not enough transmission going into the Humboldt area to serve all the load. That is one of our sublaps. Because of that physical transmission, that transfer capacity is not enough. So you have to have internal generation operating at a certain level to get it to serve the load. That's the area that you want to get your CRR to cover you on, because that's where you're going to get that huge price differential. If there was no transmission constraint, meaning I could transfer as much power between those two areas as I wanted, your CRs would be worthless because you'd have a CR price differential of zero. They'd be exactly the same. So this is where the discussion is going to be really important to start sharing what is the concerns that you have, what are the areas that you're concerned about from a transmission constraint standpoint. So the sublaps help to a certain extent, but it's dependent upon how you serve that load. So if you're scheduling load at a default, at the bigger default lap location, and that's how you're getting scheduled and settled, the sublap will not provide you what we refer to as the perfect hedge, meaning that the DLAP, if you schedule the DLAP and your CR is at the DLAP, your price differential will be exactly the same. But what if, when we were talking, what if you can't get 100% of what you want at the DLAP? Is, and this is a business decision, is getting a CR at a sublap where there's a major constraint there, is that value, which might be maybe 60% of the DLAP constrained value, is that sufficient to cover the hedge as you start scheduling at the DLAP? Those are the discussions that we want to have. Those are the back and forth, and you want to think about it from your business perspective, because everybody's, you know, got a little bit different perspective on that. So the one question that we were talking about, though, was I also needed to clarify that when you are given the sources and sinks, the injection withdrawals that we talk about for the CRs, they are related to physical sources and aggregated sink locations. And that means you have to go to that location. So when you go out to request your CRs, you can't just say, I serve load in this area, but you know what, I like the price over here. I'm going to go and request CRs there. That doesn't work. You have to actually be in that physical load location in order to request there. So that's from a sink location. Sources, there's a little bit more variability because, again, we don't know what contracts you have. We don't know what generators you own. So that's where you get a little bit more variability. Another question that Bill brought up that we were talking about is, I don't also know how you guys are going to set up or if this thing moves forward, how you would set up trading hubs. We have trading hubs set up as part of the bilateral exchange. There might be other regions, other ways to define that trading hub concept, because all you're really trying to do is identify where the risk for your congestion exposure is at. If I can define for you a location that both the provider of the energy and the person that's purchasing it know exactly what that composite of that is, what generators make it up, what allocation factors are, you both have the same information to know what your risk exposure is to that congestion. And that's kind of the key. The key is transparency, knowing what the prices are, knowing how they're calculated, knowing what makes up those components. So, again, when a lot of stuff that right now we're really talking at a high level. I, you know, every time we give presentations, You have people that are just starting. You have people that, want to go talk about the nuts and bolts. So we're kind of trying to aim a little bit in the middle to hopefully get it going. Yes.
With your Humboldt example, and I have no idea what their actual load is. But let's say they're 25 megawatts and they're a sub-DLAP inside a 400 megawatt, a sub-LAP inside a 400 megawatt DLAP, that's all, and Pacific Gas and Electric has that. They're allocated 400 megawatts of CRRs. Can they choose to take 25 of that and apply it down to the sub-LAP and then take the rest of the 375 and do it to the DLAP? Is that
absolutely. The one thing you want to think about, though, is that the best hedge is where you schedule at. So if you schedule at a DLAP location, that is where you really want to be, because from a risk aversion standpoint, that gives you the comfort that, going back to your pricing, no matter whether prices flip or not, because occasionally, and this is, I'm sorry, going to sidetrack a little bit, because I want to get to your question too, because it'll answer how the DLAPs and sublaps are important. We use the term obligations to reference the fact that CRRs can be charged or they can be paid. But keep in mind, the fact that we are making allocation available only to entities to serve load, meaning you're going in the direction of load, 95% of the time with our current market, those CRRs are revenue producers because they're going in the direction of where congestion is going to be. If we, in the auction, you can take all sorts of positions and you can go counter to congestion and be charged a lot more, but maybe you bid negative, maybe you're going to get paid. So that's another discussion maybe we'll have when we go to the auction. But for right now, think about it from the allocation perspective. The first shot through this stuff, you guys are going to be requesting stuff. It has to go in the direction of where your load is served. So when we said there are obligations, they can get charged, yeah, but the reality is that's going to be kind of unusual that there's going to be congestion counter to where everything's flowing. Not all the time. I mean, you can have certain areas, and this is where I get back to the sublap example. Sublaps can actually have a little bit different congestion exposure than the DLAPs because it's instead of having the whole region, all the shadow prices, and a portion of every shadow price, you're only banking on one. So now if you have, in your example, we have 400 megawatts that you can request, I would say it would be more likely that you would request the full 400 at the DLAP first because that's ultimately where your hedge is going to be provided. And then if you don't clear the full 400, then you go down to the sublap because sublap is only a portion of the DLAP. In Humboldt's example, it's actually a bigger portion than most of the sublaps because it's a very volatile area. And you guys will know that too. You guys will know where your constraints are, where your transmission constraints are at. So you'll know what's important to get to. But in your example, I would say more you go to the DLAP, and then if that doesn't clear, then you go to the sublap to see what you can get there and get a partial hedge for your load.
How can you have if you don't clear at the DLAP, how does it find a path to the sublap?
And this is a great question. See, these are the questions we need. So to think about what a DLAP is. So a DLAP says, I've got a 10 megawatt generator. I'm going to take this 10 megawatts and I'm going to deliver it to this DLAP. What that DLAP is the definition of all the load buses in that area. If even one load bus is constrained, the entire DLAP does not clear. Because remember, the optimization says I've got to be feasible to every constraint in that region. So if you get restricted on even one, you just don't clear anything. So that's why this iterative nature is really important, because then you see these binding constraints after the market runs, and you go, oh, that's interesting. You know, this line that's connected my load over here that's binding, and I know that that load is part of the DLAP definition. So I know unless there's some counterflow, unless something's coming out of that load location, I'm not going to clear anything in the future. So now I say I've got to go to the sublap. I pick the sublaps that are valuable that are going to provide the most of the DLAP value. Does that make sense? Oh, and I'm sorry. So then when you nominate to the sublap, now you're not going to every load bus. You're going just to these load buses over here. So those load buses, you would know by seeing the constraints. Currently, at least, none of these are binding. So that should be a safe bet. That doesn't mean that there isn't one line in there that just needs 0.1 megawatt and then it's going to bind. But at least you know it's not binding currently. Okay? Yes, sir.
Just trying to get a better understanding of the source side on the CER. So if you, sticking with that same example, if you had five generators in that lab and rely on some imports, so you would get a separate CRR for EPM generator one to that lab, generator two to that lab, and you'd have to figure out which.
And this comes down to you know best how you're going to serve your portfolio, right?
Yep.
And that's why the trading hub kind of becomes a very useful tool, because depending upon how your contracts are set up, most people, I mean, there are a lot of contracts, I don't want to say it. There's a lot of contracts done at a specific generator location. That's actually nice because you know exactly where you want to go. But if you don't know, if your contracts are out in the future, if we're doing the annual process, it's 14 months out, you might do some base loading contracts out that far, but you're not doing 100% of your load out that far. That's where the trading hub concept is useful, because the person that's providing you that energy contract, it's helpful for them, too, because they know what their exposure risk-wise from its congestion is going to be, and you know exactly where it's at. And it injects in, you take it out, and you're exposed from the taking it out of the trading hub to where your load is. They're subject to congestion getting it there. And so it kind of gives you a certain amount of certainty that you know what your exposure is going to be.
So every P-node, every trading hub is available to have CRRs on. It's not like a restricted.
We only have currently three trading hubs, NP15, SP15, ZP26. So that's just kind of that's been around since our zonal model. So, okay. Good question.
One last one, and then so who sets the size of the DLAP and then maybe determines if you're experiencing congestion on one line that's causing the DLAP to not clear, that you might want to split that into two DLAPs?
So the definition of itself initially is based on discussions and structure as we went through. Ours was based on history. I mean, you guys already have history. I'm sure you already know kind of where generally your regions would be. So depending upon, and again, remember that it's not so much the size of the load locations as much as it is what constraints are going to separate those loads. Because the constraints are the things that are going to drive the price differentials. So you could, you could have one area like Humboldt is a good example where you're very constrained, and that area is very volatile. But there's a whole bunch of policy decisions behind how do you subsidize load locations. You know, what do you make people bid at a? Maybe you make people bid at a sublab location, because then when you schedule at the sublab, you're subject to whatever the load constraints are in your area. When you go to a DLAP, you spread that cost, right? You don't have everybody paying. You have everybody paying for those constraints. You don't just have those people in a constrained area paying the high prices. Everybody kind of pays a small piece of it. And this will be part of the discussion, is that you decide, how do you want to separate out your load? Do you want everybody to share in all the constraints on the system? Or are there certain areas that you feel are volatile? And that was a big discussion for us with Humboldt, because the people in that area would end up paying a high price because they've got a high constraint value and their high shadow prices going into that area. So a bigger discussion needs to be had on that and how those things are set.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You said a few things that we should know where the constraints are on the system. Do you realize that the typical operates on that? Constraints are identified by contracts, not by votes.
That's good.
So, I mean, for mine, I'd actually ask the city court to move to a flow-based system so we can identify where the constraints, where our rights are, so that we can understand this. But right now, that's where it's sort of Greek to me, is I don't know how this is going to translate on the current system.
Okay, and that's a good education for me. I did not realize that. Part of our system is contractual based too, and we have scheduling limits that are based on contractual limits, not on physical flow limits. So we do have kind of a mixture, especially on the ties, of that type of. But you're saying that the entire system is all contractual based and.
That's what I've been told.
One of the things that will be useful with the CR simulation, whether or not we decide to move forward with this or not, it'll be a good information. And this will be my pitch to get you guys to be involved, because in order to get a realistic understanding of what possible constraints there are, we need to get all the load, as much load as possible that is really going to be modeled, get it out there and get you guys involved in the simulation. And it's good education for you guys too to see, you know, if you do decide to move forward with it, what is the impact. So that's why this outreach that PacifiCorp did to get all the LSEs together is beneficial for everybody, because you want to get that information. You want to, that's a good point, then you can make decisions that say, I see where these constraints are now, and then you can have further discussion on how you want to develop. Exactly. Good point.
Just a comment on that. It seems like the production cost modeling that we listened to in the last 2 days for SB 350 might have some signals from the WEC-wide part of the study that they did.
Yep, good point. Good questions.
Is there anything else over?
Did we address what you talked about, or did we not?
I answered
all
the questions.
Go ahead.
That's the reason why you came up with sublight. Because you can turn
the mic. Oh, the mic. How do you turn it on? Is there a button?
Pull the button forward.
Pull the button forward on top.
On.
There. Is it on?
Yeah. Is that the reason why you came up with sublights? Because of the default path was such a, like,
The intent again was to provide flexibility for hedge. So we recognize that, and this is another good question because this kind of prompted me to think something else. Remember that when we do the when we do the CR process, we're going to give people the ability to request up to their max of their load eventually through the monthly process, but it's not mandatory, meaning that you don't have to have everybody nominating, everybody requesting at the same time. So you sometimes through the CR process, you don't get what I would say is an absolute realistic picture of how the load is going to be served, because maybe they're requesting only 80% of their CRs for their load, or maybe they're requesting at locations that aren't necessarily exactly how they're going to serve their load. But we wanted to give people flexibility to go ahead and pick the hedge that they want to get where they think their exposure is at. And that's the concept, right, is that we can make that determination for you. You go and make that determination. So I can sit here and say, if I had my choice, I'd always want to go to the DLAP. But if you can't get there, where do you go? What is going to provide you the next best bet? And that's where the sublaps came in, is it'll clear. Maybe it won't give you 100% of the DLAP price, but maybe it gives you 70%, and maybe that's enough for some of the – remember I was saying that your CRs are going to – oh, this is the other question that we were talking about. CRs pay out every hour you hold them, whether or not you're scheduling. So that's why when I was saying that our studies roughly have shown that if you get 75 to 80% of your allocation, you are given 100% hedge because of the fact that some hours – there's no congestion, in which the CRs aren't going to pay anything. Other hours when there is congestion, maybe you're not scheduling your full amount. Maybe you're scheduling 7 of your 10, but you have 10 megawatts of CRs, so you still get the full, you get paid on the 10, because that's what the congestion rents are coming in at. So over time, the intent is that it will cover and provide for that hedge. But that's a decision that, you know, again, that's why I can say a sublap might be a good bet if you're getting 70% of the hedge of the DLAP, because of the variability across the hours. So that was kind of the intent. Okay. Sorry.
This is good. You know, when I started today, I said I wanted to make sure that the questions that you came into the room with, that you have those answered by the time you leave the room. So this is your time. So you that we're here. To answer these for you. Don't think, I wish I would have asked such and such. Maybe I'll have to call him on the phone. We've got Jim in this chair, and I won't let him leave until we get your questions answered. Tegan, do we have anybody on the phone who has a question based on any of the discussion that we've been having here in the room? Okay, let's move on to CRR auction. I'm doing a time check. We do need to allow the folks here and the folks on the phone to break for some sustenance in a few minutes, so we're going to go for about 15 minutes, and then we are going to do a lunch break at noon. And so we'll go through a few more slides, and then we'll do that, and then we'll come back, and we'll finish up, and we'll have plenty of time for the rest of the material and also additional questions. I like this, you know, getting to be quite interactive. I think that, you know, this is why we're here, is to bring this information to you and help you kind of work through it so that you're, you know, informed about what this whole thing about CRRs are, is. All right, so lots of R's, lots, too many R's today. All right, so Tegan, let's go to the next slide, please. So we talked this morning about allocation. Now we're going to talk about auction. Now, in the allocation, there was, you have to be eligible, you have to be an LSC, there are certain requirements. With the auction, all entities can participate in the auction that have, number one, registered as a candidate CRR holder with the IFO. So you have to register or apply to be part of the auction. And then you have to post minimum required collateral for participation. If you are participating in the annual auction, that's $500,000. If you are participating in the monthly auction, that's $100,000. So there needs to be, basically, you have to register and you have to provide the collateral, and then you're able to participate in the auction. Next slide, please. So with the auction, it is a bid-based market that produces market clearing prices, or MCP, for every AP node, aggregated price node. Based on that market clearing price for each CRR awarded, the holder may incur a charge if it's a positive MCP, incur no charge, the MCP is zero for the CRR, or be paid by the ISO if there's a negative MCP. The annual auction begins after the four-tiered annual allocation process that we talked about at length. The CRRs are awarded in 4 3-month durations equal to 12 months. So there's that seasonality that we talked about. The monthly auction begins after the two-tiered monthly allocation process. And then CRRs awarded here are in 1 month duration. Next slide, please. All bids in the CRR auction, all bids that are submitted are subject to initial validations of maximum portfolio credit exposure against the aggregate credit limit. There is also this simultaneous feasibility test with all of the previously allocated CRRs for the same period and time of use modeled as fixed injections and withdrawals. Next slide, please. So we started talking about these injections and withdrawals or sources and sinks. So we have a list here of currently in our system in the auction, there are these available injections and withdrawals. So we've got the generating unit P node or the price node there at that generating unit, a trading hub which Jim was describing earlier. We have the load aggregation point or the LAP. We have the metered subsystem LAP. We have the sub-LAP, which Jim was also talking about, and then we have specific scheduling points. So in the auction, these are all allowable sinks or sources or injections and withdrawals. Next slide, please. So the market clearing price for all CRR AP nodes or aggregated price nodes will be published after each market. And then in general, the clearing price of a CRR is the market clearing price at the source or the injection minus the market clearing price at the sink or the withdrawal. Next slide, please. Before we talk about load migration, because it's a whole other topic, we had less slides about the auction. There was a whole bunch of processes we were talking about in allocation. When the auction, we kind of laid it out pretty straightforward. But I want to make sure that that is enough for you, or if it's not, that we can answer any questions that you might have.
Okay. And this might not be specific to the auction, but is it treating both source and sink at a trading hub, one, and then two, how are trading hubs modeled in the feasibility test to create a source and sink and identify the relevant buses?
Good point. So it is different for allocation and auction. So remember we were saying that in the allocation, you have to sink it at your load. So in the allocation, the only way you can get a trading hub is to source it. So it has to be that. For the auction, though, you're right. You have people going, taking positions both ways, because it truly is more of a pure financial market when you're looking at the auction, because you have participants in there that do not serve load. They're just taking financial positions. So from that standpoint, you can take whatever position you want. There's no limitation. And you said the trading hub definition or...
Well, what if you have more injections from a trading hub than, or withdrawals from a trading hub than injections in? How do you even it out, essentially, in order to identify what buses you're actually getting zeros for, or to balance it, essentially?
So, again, good question. So now think about it from the standpoint of everything is subject to the SFT, right? So it doesn't, there's no artificial says, oh, you can't have so many injections and withdrawals at any particular location. It's just that as long as everything netted together does not exceed any limits that you are enforcing. So you could have 1,000 megawatts being taken out of the trading hub and only 500 going into it. As long as there's no external, no lines are being exceeded, no branch groups, no contingencies are being bound or anything of that nature. So it's really just the constraints that you're looking at. And this brings up another good point. The model that we build or that we use for the CR, why it is so critically important that it be the same model or as close as possible to the same model that is used in the day-ahead market, is because that maintains revenue adequacy. I can tell you for sure that if I use the exact same constraints that the day-ahead market uses for 1 hour, I can guarantee you revenue adequacy for that 1 hour. The problem is that CRs aren't done for just 1 hour. Day-ahead market, hour by hour, can change. For the CR market, we're doing an entire season for time use. So when we look at the LDFs that we use, the load distribution factors that we use for the DLAPs, and I think this might have been where you were going too, is it's not exactly the same as the day-ahead market, because the day-ahead market, it fluctuates. There's lines taken out, maybe it takes out a load point, or they come back in. But on average, and we use about a three-year average of the LDFs, if it fluctuates and gets relatively close, and the good thing about the DLAP is you're spreading it out over a lot of load points, so you're not getting a heavy concentration in certain areas, so it kind of helps with those LDFs being averaged out to get you that price to where what the day-ahead brings in for congestion rents is equivalent to what you're going to pay out for your CRs. I can tell you that it doesn't work out that way. It's not a perfect world, but by trying to get that as close as possible is where it's really critical that we work really well with the PTOs that know when the outages are going to happen, that know what the line limits are going to be changed to, know what reconductoring is being done. You know, all that stuff that is so critical to making sure that CRRs are feasible financially based on the physical model, because you guys are going to get paid those CRRs. If there's LSEs in our current market, if there's a shortfall, if we don't collect enough, if we sell 1,000 megawatts of CRs on a line that's only collecting 500 megawatts of congestion because we didn't have the right model limit, guess who pays? The load pays in the current structure. So that's why it's so critical that we make that as close as possible, because it's our goal is to balance releasing as many CRs that are feasible that can be paid on to the LSEs and to the auction participants, because it's all got to be paid at the end of the day. And so we want to make that model as close as possible, and we want to release as much as possible so you can get the hedge that you need to serve the load.
So then the difference in the model would be like unplanned outages, right? So I could, if I was getting CRs for a sublap for my load, but then there's an outage, I might end up binding on a bus that I hadn't even contemplated necessarily, right? And
exactly.
I lost in that situation. Okay.
Exactly. And there's another situation. You know, because the timing variability of when we run the auction and the allocation for the CR versus when the market is actually operated is really the key driver. So what happens, operator comes along, you know what, we had this happen in 2014, very bad hydro year. Well, we had two contingencies that were binding during those times. And so those contingencies, guess what, they showed up in real time. We didn't know about it because a year ahead, we didn't know that they were going to be there. So this is where the transfer of information is so critical to this thing, and the exchange of information, the exchange of data is so critical to making sure that the market itself operates as expected. But the reality is you just can't possibly predict everything that's going to happen, but you try to build in some variability. The reason why we only release 75% of system capacity in annual is because of that invariability, is that when it comes, if we release 75% and then the month comes along and all of a sudden this line is taken down 50%, we've oversold. And so that's where that information is very critical. The modeling is so important to maintaining the revenue adequacy of it. Good question.
Yep. I think you were kind of going there, but without getting into any of the, you know, dragging into the politics of it, can you explain a little bit some of the difficulties that have gone on the last few years with revenue inadequacy in the CRRs and just kind of talk through that a little bit?
It's not policy. There's policies on how to resolve it, but the reality is, as I can almost always point to an outage, an unplanned outage, almost, I would say, 95% of the time. And I should back up. Outages drive constraints, too. So if there's a particular line limit that our line is being taken out and we're concerned about this overloading another line, well, we create a contingency. You know, Robert talked about the constraints that are enforced in the market. Contingencies are one of those. What if you have a loss of an additional line that then creates an overload? When you have that put into the market, it creates this, what we call, and I'm sorry, I use the term shadow price just means that there's a constraint on the system. But it creates a price differential between where that constraint is on both sides. And that then creates the pricing for the CRs. Well, if we don't model it in the CR, let's say there's 1,000 megawatt transfer limit between the two, we award CRs 1,000 megawatts because there's no constraint there, just the thermal limit of that line. If a contingency comes along and says, you know, the contingency is we're going to take only 50% of the flow on this. We're only going to allow 50% flow on this line when this line is out. Well, then that means that they're only collecting congestion rents in the day-ahead market for 500 megawatts. But guess what? We're going to pay out 1,000 megawatts. So that creates that shortfall. So to get to your question, there's some politics and policy behind how you want to resolve the revenue inadequacy. And this will be, you guys will have this discussion if you decide to go forward with it too, is how do you allocate out that shortfall? That's a discussion. Right now, the current market is we allocate it to demand, which is load and exports. Should it be allocated maybe to all CR holders? Maybe the auction participants should share in it, maybe not. So those are the policy, politics decisions. There's discussions about how to allocate. Maybe you allocate shortfall by constraint. There's a paper out by our DMM that basically said, you know what, if there's a shortfall due to this constraint, we're going to pay out 1,000. The example I was using, we paid out 1,000 megawatts on this constraint, but you know what, if we only collected 500, then maybe what we do is we take 50% of the payments that we made and we don't do what we call full funding. We do partial funding. So maybe that's an option. And so that's something to think about too. So is that kind of where you were going?
Yeah, and does oversupply also, is that also causing issues with it, or are you kind of taking that into account when you're looking at how much to release?
The overgen type situations, when you say oversupply?
If something isn't accounted for in day ahead, but it's consistently showing up in real time, is that impacting?
But it's more of the constraint side. So as long as we're modeling the constraints accurately, that's why generators aren't necessarily the driver for pricing differential. It's really, is there a bunch of generation that's coming on that's creating an overload, but is that overload the same overload limit? Is that the same thermal limit that the CR and Bayhead are running with? If it is, from a purely financial perspective, we could care if the shadow price went to $1 million. because what's collected in the day ahead is what would be paid out in the CR model. So from that standpoint, it doesn't have any impact. It's just if the limits are different, if the constraints are different, that's where it comes in.
So it would be if it impacted, if the pattern of generation impacted the forecasted constraint?
It would have to be the actual limit itself. It really, you know, if there's generation of 1,000 megawatts, and you're not talking about like nodal group constraints, that type of concept, because that's a different animal. So yeah, no, if you're just talking physical constraints, as long as we're modeling it, doesn't matter what the generation limits are, as long as we're modeling the constraints in the same way that the day ahead market is. Okay.
So I think what we'll do now, good discussion. It's a minute after noon. Let's take our lunch break. For those of you on the phone, we'll be joining back with you in an hour, so feel free to step away from your desks as well and take your lunch break now. We're going to break for lunch. We'll be back in an hour, and we'll go through the rest of the presentation and any additional questions that come up as well. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you. All right, everybody. Welcome back to you on the phone and to you in the room. Thank you for getting back together with us. So this next topic we're going to talk about is load migration. Just maybe two slides on this. And really, this is, I had some notes because I wanted to make sure I framed this properly. So this is a process the ISO currently has. Truly, we're not sure how it will relate to the PacifiCorp ISO integration should that actually occur. It is something that would be worked out in a future stakeholder process, but we thought it would be a good idea just to bring up how this is working today in the ISO balancing area. Next slide, please. So what is load migration? Load migration is the process of tracking the transfer of load between a pair of load-serving entities. When this load migration occurs, the ISO transfers a portion of the entire CRR portfolio from one load-serving entity to the other. This is a process that occurs on a monthly basis. There's obviously coordination involved between, you know, when the start and stop time of this will happen. As Jim was mentioning, CRRs are paid out hourly, so at the finest, most detailed level, in 1 hour, there can only be one CRR holder for that specific CRR that will be paid for that hour. So where the break point is in the month or the day is something that gets determined, but essentially we transfer a portion of the CRR portfolio from one load-serving entity to the other. Next slide, please. The purpose for doing this, for implementing the load migration process, is to ensure that each market participant's CRR portfolio would be accurate in the event of a transfer of load between those LSEs. And we have an example in the reference section of how this process might occur. There's a detailed example where we walk through some numbers. So if you wanted to later turn to the reference section, you can kind of see how that transaction plays out and what the process looks like. Next slide, please. So now we're going to talk about settlement of CRRs. Now, before we go there, do we have any lingering questions about auction or allocation before we want to start talking about the settlement of them?
And it might, we weren't sure, so it might be. But for California, we have direct access rules.
Okay.
So for direct access, we actually do see load migrating month to month, going from UDC to an LA, to an, what we call ESPs. Again, I'm not sure. I mean, but ours is actually they now have community aggregation choice. So now it's aggregation of communities. So it's becoming more popular now. So now a question to you guys, do you have load, is there direct access here?
Yes, sir. A little bit.
Yes. I'm sorry, what was that?
In the state of Oregon.
In only Oregon?
Correct. Right now it's only in Oregon.
Okay. So this might be a small piece of...
It happens, but ours is on an annual...
Oh, it's annual.
There's an annual process to switch.
That makes it cleaner, at least. So.
It might not line up very well with the timing of the... our approach, because it happens in December.
Yeah, and actually, it would actually, I mean, it's more cumbersome now with the month-to-month because you're transferring pieces of portfolios. And so once a year actually makes it a lot better because you get, when you transfer an entire portfolio, you're transferring 1% of everybody's ownership. So 1% goes to LSE1, and then LSE1 loses 0.5%, and it goes to LSE3, and you get this myriad of CRs getting created. So I would like once a year it actually be. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. So in the settlement of CRR section, we have an example, the calculation that we'll talk through today, just one, and then information about the CRR balancing account. Next slide, please. So we've put together a basic example for you to explain how a CRR provides what we call this perfect hedge. The example that we're using has a load-serving entity with its own generator, A, scheduling to a sink location, B. So generator to sink, source to sink, A to B. In the scenario, the load-serving entity has a CRR with the same source sink as their schedule. So that's how we're framing this example, and then we're going to walk through a simple calculation over the next two slides. Next slide, please. So first, if we look at an example of the settlement for the physical schedule, and we're just talking about this congestion piece of it, if we've got a 10-megawatt schedule, let's say, from A to B, there is the schedule source at A, and there's that marginal cost of congestion. And we just put this together as an example, so we're saying that's $5. So if you and the sink at B, the marginal cost of congestion there is $15. The calculation is the LMP, the congestion piece of that at the source, minus the congestion piece of that at the sink, multiplied by the schedule megawatt. So if we walk through the math very simply, we put those numbers into the calculation, and we've got the source minus the sink multiplied by the scheduled megawatt, so we've got 5 minus 15 is negative 10 multiplied by 10 megawatts equals $100 charge to the load serving entity. That's for the physical schedule. And then next slide, please. And then the settlement of the CRR, again, that's just that congestion piece. For the settlement of the CRR, it's the sink minus the source multiplied by the CRR megawatt. So we have that same 10-megawatt CRR from A to B. The source at A is $5. The sink at B is $15. This is that congestion cost. So we take the sink minus the source, or 15 minus 5, multiplied by the CRR megawatt, and that equals out to be $100 payment to the LSE. So there's a charge of 100 and a payment of 100. Next slide shows 0. That equals perfect hedge. If you could switch to the next slide, please. So that's a very simplified example of what a perfect hedge looks like. Are there any questions about that?
CRRs operate independently of the LMP price. So could you get a positive CRR and a negative price?
That's a good question. We were talking a little bit about it. Is it possible for the prices to flip? And it is. Pretty infrequent from the example we're using is congestions in the direction of going to the sink location. In the example, though, what would end up happening is your schedule would have been paid and your CR would charge you. You'd still end up with a perfect hedge. And so from a risk minimization standpoint, the point we're trying to get across is as long as your schedule and your CR are matching, from your perspective, from a financial perspective, you don't care what the price does because you're going to get paid and charged or charged and paid. It just is going to flip. The CR just flips the payment or flips the formula for how you get settled. Now, obviously, if you only did one or the other, then you'd want to be concerned about it. But does that get to your question or no?
Well, I mean,
there we go.
All right.
Just right.
You wouldn't have positive. Would you have positive congestion? I guess a positive CR on a negative price, which means the load would get paid to take in that energy and then get paid the positive congestion. Because I'd assume that negative prices result in oversupply situations where congestion would more likely be part of that.
Right. So really, what your example is, it's possible to happen, especially in overgen situations where the congestion could be in the opposite direction, right? So you're getting a situation where a constraint is binding in a direction that is not going to load but going away from load.
Well, wouldn't the energy still be flowing into the load in a negative market? It'd just be sucking it all in.
Yeah, but it's the constraint that's setting that price differential, right? So we're kind of coming up with a scenario where we're saying there's this constraint. Let's assume nothing else is binding on the system. Everything else is fine except that there's a generation location that's overloading, and it just so happens it's creating a price differential where it's higher now on the generator side than it is on the load side. And it's kind of, and overgen is what you're bringing up. It's kind of an example of where that could happen. But it's the constraint that's driving the price differential. So it's not necessarily where the load is located on in relation to where the constraint is happening. And then you have to talk about where the direction of the congestion is going, where that constraint is. So that's why in this, from an allocation perspective, it's pretty unusual. We do see it happen occasionally, but it's pretty unusual. Most of the time, the congestion, because everything is like you're saying, the generators flow into the load, but unless there's this unique constraint that maybe the output of that generator is going to be limited, then there's going to be a constraint applied at that generator location.
Okay. Okay. I think I follow.
Kind of.
Okay.
So in this example, it was a perfect hedge to the generator company sank to their own load, didn't have to kind of basically pay anybody else for that. But then back on slide 56, we just talked about the auction. And so you were in this example to get that CR at auction. And at auction, there was like a clearing price for that CR. So you would, in theory, maybe have paid $10 for the CR. Is that how it works?
So it depends on where, again, this is where everybody makes their assumption on what the value of that congestion is going to be. You and I could have different assumptions on, we could say that we know this line's going to constrain. We know it's going to constrain in the direction of the load, but we don't know how much it's going to constrain. I could think it's going to be $2. You could think it's only going to be $1. So you're willing to pay $1 or less for it. I'm willing to pay $2 or less for it because I think it's going to be a higher value. So that's where the clearing prices start driving a little bit of expectation, at least, not necessarily reality, but expectation of what the value of that hedge. Because if you pay for something, you're going to say, hey, well, in return, I'm going to get paid this as the day ahead market settles hour by hour. I'm expecting my CR to bring in a little bit of money to me. So, and you're hoping it's going to at least equal what you paid or more. Make sense?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, next slide, please. So that was a simplified example, like I said, of a perfect hedge. Now we're going to talk through a couple of slides that explain the CRR balancing account and the concept of full funding. So the CRR balancing account was created to assist in addressing the full funding requirement of CRRs. The intention behind this, the ISO tries to prevent revenue inadequacy from happening by performing those simultaneous feasibility tests that we talked about when we're running the allocation and the auction process. The simultaneous feasibility test is applied to help ensure that the level of CRRs, the megawatt quantity or quantities, that are either allocated or auctioned do not create entitlements that generate more payout to CRR holders than what is actually brought into the ISO by that congestion revenue in the day-ahead market. Next slide, please. And as Jim was saying, if we talk about one specific hour and a price and a megawatt value, then you can be more certain about how things will occur and have somewhat of a guarantee. But if you take a look at the market in a whole, hour by hour, across many days and months, it's not possible to guarantee that exactly what we bring in will be paid out. Am I doing that in the right direction? And so we have the concept of this balancing account. We use this account to offset those hours where there might be a mismatch between the payment and the revenue for congestion. Next slide, please. So we have a chart to walk through, an example, and we've got there's a circle on the left-hand side here, and that's the hourly CRR settlement process. So we settle these CRR payments hourly. Going into that settlement process are the day-ahead congestion revenues. Excluding those transmission ownership rights and existing transmission contracts that we talked about earlier that have that perfect head scenario. In addition, there is also the congestion revenues from day-ahead ancillary service imports. That is all paid out to CRR holders based on the day-ahead LMP for that specific hour. And then we have a concept of a surplus or a shortfall being cleared through the CRR balancing account. So over there on the right side of the chart, we have this CRR balancing account. The CRR auction revenues go into that account. And then based on whether or not the congestion revenue is either greater than or equal to the CRR entitlement, any overages or surplus gets put into the balancing account for a future time where the congestion revenue would be less than those entitlements, and then that shortfall gets paid out of or pulled out of that balancing account. We do this invoicing on a weekly basis, and we clear that balancing account weekly as well. Was there anything else about this chart you wanted to share?
I just want to chat just about the concept.
Go ahead. Anyway. Yeah. Have the floor.
Because we kind of have talked about, we use the term, we throw it around, revenue adequacy. And give you guys a concept there. There's really two ways of defining revenue adequacy the way that it's set up. In the perfect world, like we said, we're trying to make sure that the day-ahead market constraints equal what the CR is doing. In the perfect world, revenue adequacy would mean day-ahead market runs. If there's congestion on the system, day-ahead market calculates shadow price, charges people that have shift factors or use that capacity, and then that money would be exactly what you collect, would be what you paid out in your CRs if our models were exactly the same. That's perfect world revenue adequacy. The next step in what Rada is going through here is kind of a modification to it because of the fact that we know that there's going to be temporal changes between when the CR model is set and when the day-ahead market runs. So what we've done is we said, okay, now since we have this auction, because there's two ways you can do this. You could just, you know, say allocate only and everything stays the same and we don't collect auction revenues, but we don't sell out any additional capacity. In which case then you basically, if you collect more congestion than capacity of the CRs that you sold out, then that just all goes into the balancing account. We did it where we said, we'll let the auction participants, because everybody, even LSEs, could participate in the auction, let them go in and set the value of what that capacity is worth. And what we'll do is we'll take that money and we'll use it as a buffer account. So this is what the balancing account is intended for. It's intended for those times where maybe we released 1,000 megawatts of CRs, but we're only going to collect day-ahead market congestion rents on 750. So we kind of fill in the gaps. At the end of the day, from an LSE's perspective, in our current market right now, the concern, I would say one of the major concerns is going to be, at the end of the day, are you going to allocate a shortfall to me or are you going to allocate a surplus? Meaning, did the ISO's auction market collect more congestion, more auction rents than had to be paid out in total? So that's where it rests.
for every year except for 2014, where we had the hydro issues, we were, at the end of the year, net surplus, meaning the LSEs ended up getting a little bit of money. The value is really the question that is being debated. I'll just toss it out there so you guys can, at some point, think about it. Is the value you get from the auction equal to or less than the value if you had just held on to that capacity and just let the day-ahead market rents collect? So as an example, if we go in and we basically say, okay, we're going to sell, we have 10 megawatts of additional capacity on this one line. If we go ahead and sell it in the auction, and auction participants are taking on a risk because they're looking out in the future and they're saying, boy, I don't know exactly what this thing is going to be worth. I think it's going to be worth a dollar. So I'm going to pay you, ISO, I'm going to pay you now $10 to put into your balancing account. If the value of that is more than $10, then in theory, if you hindsight in 2020, if you could say, I just would have kept that capacity, and if it was worth $20, day-ahead market would have collected $20 and just put it into a separate balancing account. Instead of the $10 now, we'll think that the $20 is going to be there in the future. I've explained it. Conceptually, that's where you can go with this. There's ways of viewing the market as it gets set up. Obviously, the market we have right now is set up to where the auction is what drives the value of those CRs or of any additional capacity. The other point to toss out there is that in the auction, you're not just selling capacity that is quote-unquote available, because people ask the question, when you get to the auction, how much is left? And the answer is as much as somebody wants to take a counter position on, meaning if I have a line that is good for 100 megawatts of capacity, and let's say it's completely taken up in the allocation, you could get two different participants like you and I were talking about. I thought congestion was going to be $2. You thought it was going to be a dollar. I'm willing to pay $2. You know what? Maybe you put a bid in, says, give me $2 now. I'll provide counterflow, and our bids would clear. There was no additional capacity, but it was just a position, a financial position that you're taking. And it has no impact to the market because ultimately the market is still going to collect the congestion rents on whatever capacity is in the market is available, about 100 megawatts. The amount that you and I just traded, we're just going to end up paying each other or trading in the market. So there's two schools of thought about what the benefit, you know, the intent behind putting a liquid market out there is that you try to get that auction clearing price will hopefully get driven closer and closer to what the day ahead is going to be with the risk factor built in, obviously, because you're putting a, something of future value on something that you really don't have any idea how much it's really going to be. Just go.
I think I follow some of that, but just a real quick question. So in the allocation, you don't get any benefit if you say they're going to allocate you 100 megawatts of CRRs, and you say, well, I don't want it, I don't need it. That just then, assuming all the other steps get followed, gets put into the auction bucket.
The balancing account.
The balancing account. And that those dollars just flow into a generic balancing account. They don't flow back to the LSE that's waived or right or whatever.
Exactly. And this is actually a good question because there are some folks that maybe have a small portfolio of energy, maybe it's not cost worthy to say to pay the cost to participate in the market because you're really your risk exposure is maybe minimal. So maybe you don't want to get CRs. Maybe you don't want to go into the CR market. Maybe you just go, you know what, I feel comfortable that I'm not going to be exposed to that much, so you just don't do it because the cost to participate maybe is not worth it to them. But that is the key, is that if you decide that from a business perspective that it's your business decision not to participate, we take that money. Still, we collect that money from whoever uses it. So you're going to use it. If there's congestion, you're going to pay congestion rents, and then it's just going to get distributed to all loads. So you'd get a piece of it back, but it's just going to go into the balancing account and get redistributed.
And when you're allocating CRs, it doesn't cost the LSE anything to be allocated because you're already paying it through the TAC, basically.
Exactly.
One question we had at lunch that we were trying to figure out. So CRRs act as a perfect hedge or roughly thereof in the day-ahead market. So there's when you get to the real-time market and there's real-time pricing in the 15 or 5 minutes, you don't have any hedge there. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. And actually, Rada made that point. You think about what's the incentive then to get, because one of the concerns that we had, the Kyle ISO, our market, was we started seeing a shift from people dropping their day-ahead schedules to go into, then just say, hey, I'm going to wait I'm gonna you know, arbitrage on the real time price. Well, then that creates a lot of uncertainty. A lot of issues come up in real time. So this gives an incentive to the LSEs to get as much scheduled in the day ahead so they can get that pitch. Okay.
Yep. So when the balancing account is cleared on a weekly basis, then is that allocated out to like a meter demand?
Exactly. Yep. Actually, oh, that's right. Next slide. No, no.
That is on the next slide.
No, but is that what you were? Yeah.
So speaking of, nice segue. Thank you. So we'll walk through this and then we'll take any other questions. So full funding is performed on an hourly basis, with any surplus or shortfall calculated for each of those hours being tracked in the CRR balancing account, and the clearing is performed then on a weekly basis. Any revenue surplus or shortfall amounts in the CRR balancing account will be distributed, either charged or paid, to the scheduling coordinators using the following formula. So they take the scheduling coordinator's metered demand, which is the net of demand served by ETCs and TORs, divided by the total measured demand for all SCs, multiplied by the CRR balancing account balance, whether it be positive or negative, and then that gets either charged out or paid out. And I think there was something else I wanted to say about that. There's also, so we talked about the CRRs are funded hourly, then we do the revenue surplus or shortfall in the balancing account weekly. There's also, just for the sake of completeness and transparency, one of our favorite words, there's also a monthly allocation of accrued interest from the investment of the auction revenues. So there's a specific document that addresses each specific settlement charge in the market in great detail. So we have what's called a business practice manual for settlements, and then each settlement charge has its own specific code number. And then there is a configuration guide, really a description of why this charge exists, the formulas that are used to calculate it, the things that go into that charge, the things that that charge then feeds into. So there's great detail about this. I also wanted to point out that the monthly allocation of that accrued interest as well. Next slide, please. Oh, and we have a question.
Rich made a comment about the TAC, and I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about the interplay between those who pay the TAC and how CRRs factor into the overall world.
And it's not so much a rationale behind why LSEs get allocated, we say, for free, because basically all you're doing, you're getting an allotment that you're allowed to request based on the fact that you serve load within whatever area you're in. The TAC rationale is that's what, in theory, right, is the congestion is being charged out because there's some limitation on a transmission constraint that's not sufficient to handle whatever is being put on it. So paying for the upkeep of the operation and maintenance of the transmission system through the TAC, we say, well, you know what, you guys are paying for that, so this is kind of the refund of that by letting you go and participate in the allocation. Says that's the relationship between that pay and TAC and getting the CRs allocated to you.
But okay. The same thing happens for measured demand, which is also exports.
Right? Exports included.
Still get wrapped up in it, but don't get allocated CRs.
But they are able to go ahead and we allow them to. This is the OBALSIs that we talk about. That's the relationship for the export. So the export is anytime you're going and wheeling, using, I'll say for us, using CAISO transmission, and you're basically then exporting, leaving the system, you can go through and get CRs through that OBALSI treatment. It's a little bit different rules because of the fact that you're not mandated to use ISO grid. If, you know, the people that are in the balancing authority area, they have no choice. Their load is in that area, so they have to use that transmission. For entities outside, in theory, you could build generation internal and serve it that way, but if you decide not to, that's why any surplus also gets allocated out to the demand also, meaning load and exports. But you can participate as an OBALSI, and that's why they included exports in that allocation.
Can you give an
example of an OBAL?
Oh, I see. Yeah. So in our area, we have Sacramento Municipal Utility District. So basically what you have is they have actually power they bring in through Captain Jack or through Malin and bring it down and wheel it through the ISO transmission grid, and then it leaves us. Whenever you export, you're basically paying for the use of that transmission to get it to that export point. That's the what we refer to as the wheeling access charge, so the export rate. So you pay whether you have CRs or not or go into that, so you're going to pay it. So the concept is if you know you're going to schedule, you know you're going to bring 100 megawatts in every hour for on peak, let's say, then it makes sense to go ahead and just prepay that WACC, go and get an allocated CR to cover yourself, and then you basically get it for free. You're going to pay the billing access charge because you know you're going to use it. The downside is if you're not sure how much you're going to use to transfer through. So if you say you prepay 100 megawatts, but you only use 80 megawatts through the year, then that additional amount just goes to the PTOs and you lose it. The other side to think about, though, is for these OBALCs, the reason we don't see much is because typically as an export, you're basically going opposite congestion. You're leaving where the load is getting served, the majority of the load is. So from a financial standpoint, it almost doesn't make any sense because you'd end up, if you schedule it, you're almost going to get paid anyway just on your schedule. Remember that formula we were looking at? The front formula, you would get paid. So the CR is just going to take money away from you. So to date, we have not had any OBALZ participate yet. But again, depends upon the transmission system. Okay.
Any other questions on that? Okay, so we're going to go through the next couple slides here. In addition to the settlement of the actual CRR charge, we're going to talk about these additional considerations. So there's some GNC charges and other financial considerations that we wanted to bring up. So there are two types of CRR related grid management charges. The ISO charges certain fees to recoup the cost for running the market. The first is what is called the CRR services charge. So this is designed to recover costs the ISO incurs running the CRR markets. They're applied to each CRR holder's net megawatt holdings of CRRs that are applicable to each hour. And it's calculated by dividing the annual GNC revenue, the revenue that we collect for the grid management charge, that's allocated to the CRR service category. We divide that by the forecasted annual sum of the awarded megawatt of CRRs per hour. Next slide, please. And then we have the CRR bid transaction fee, and that's designed to recover the costs on a transactional basis. It applies both to the allocation and to the auction process. It is on a per nomination or per bid basis without consideration of the number of segments. The reason why we put that there is when you're bidding into the day-ahead market, each bid that you place can have up to 10 segments, and there's a bid transaction fee on those segments. We're saying with the CRRs, there is no consideration of the number of segments. There's just a fee on the per nomination, which is a request for allocation, or a per bid basis. These rates can be updated intra-year to reflect actual cost collection. Next slide, please. Is there anything more, Jim, that you wanted to add about those GNC charges, or does anybody have a question about those?
I had a question on the services charge. So that slide there, I guess you're talking about how you come up with the rate that gets applied to the CR, whatever the activity is, if it's nominations or what it is. So like in your example, going back, is it just like the 10 megawatts then gets that GMC rate?
Yeah, so every megawatt or every CR is converted to megawatt hours. Okay. Because remember, your CR is by TOU, so it's either on peak or off peak. So your 10 megawatts then, if that's the only one you held for that on, let's say it's on peak, yep, you get an assessment 10 megawatt hours every on peak hour.
Okay. Got it. And then on the bid transaction fee, so you know, where there's the multiple tiers that you're bidding on each,
yep,
time, so you're saying so each tier kind of incurs another one. Okay.
Yeah. And one way to look at the GMC is really the bucket is set, right? You know how much cost needs to be recovered. It's a matter of how do you allocate that cost out. So how are you going to collect it? So they've broken it up into a bid, a flat transaction, a dollar per transaction, and then plus, like, I forget what, like three-tenths of a cent or something per megawatt hour. But they, ultimately, the intent is they're going to collect whatever is needed to run the, pay for the auction software, or the software that we operate, pay for the maintenance, and that stuff. So, okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
So the next slide here describes, now we're going to kind of switch topics, but it's another financial consideration, the concept of convergence bidding or virtual bidding, which you may or may not be familiar with, and how congestion revenue rights can be affected by that, and the CRR settlement rule put in place that was designed to ensure that entities are not using their convergence bids to enhance the value of their CRR portfolio. So, a convergence bid or a virtual bid can affect congestion on a particular constraint. It can either increase or decrease congestion on the constraint, and that activity could enhance the entity's CRR. And I have a slide coming up that will explain a little bit about convergence bidding. So the CRR settlement rule identifies constraints that are affected by the activity of that entity's convergence bids. And the change in congestion revenue is then charged back to the CRR holder if the ISO's Department of Market Monitoring, Jim had mentioned DMM before, so that's what he meant by Department of Market Monitoring, if they determine the amount of the constraint change in congestion actually enhanced the entity's CRR portfolio. Next slide, please.
Just one comment, because... And this is, DMM is who put together the rules, but the rules are set. So it's not, they go take a look at it and see, is, you know, it's not an assessment. It's basically the rules are set. It's like 10% to the shift factor, 10% is some amount of impact on the megawatt flows. So the rules are out there. It is very involved, very complicated, but it's something that's automated. Basically, it goes through the settlements process, and then the rules are already set there.
So right, so you're saying the Department of Market Monitoring doesn't look at each situation and then allow the charges to go through or not. We do have I have a list of the rules that are coming up. So after this slide here that explains convergence bidding, for those folks who may not be familiar with it, convergence bidding or virtual bidding is part of FERC's standard market design. So it's something that exists in all energy markets that have a day-ahead energy market. They are financial positions that are taken in the day-ahead market at a specific location, hour and megawatt value and price, and then liquidated at that same time in the real-time market. So a virtual bid does not have to have any physical backing behind it. You can bid as if you were demand by placing a virtual demand bid at a location, and essentially you're saying this is a bid to buy at the day-ahead price and then sell back at the real-time price. And to the market, when it's running, when we're running the day-ahead market, it looks like price-sensitive demand. So it could have an effect on congestion is what we're saying. With virtual supply, suppliers sell. So a virtual supply bid is a bid to sell in the day-ahead market price and then buy back at the real-time price at that specific location. This looks to the market like a dispatchable supply resource. So as the market clears, there may be congestion implications because of this that are then recouped through the CRR holder rights that they have. And so what they do is take a look at, if you could go to the next slide, please. There are specific rules that we follow to make sure that they're not unfairly taking advantage of that. So we have, and we have some animation on this slide that if you wouldn't mind clicking through the first one. So we've got an example here of an energy company, and they have CRR agreements, and they have convergence bidding agreements, and so they have different portions or slices of the company taking care of different things. So the first box down at the bottom, that some of them have physical generation, and then maybe two other organizations have virtual bidding that they're doing. And so all of that activity, if you could click onto the next animation, both of that physical and convergence bidding activity impacts the congestion. And so then when you take a look at the CRR holding or their CRR portfolio, if the bids that they are placing are determined to impact that CRR revenue specific to subject to specific criteria that we're going to walk through in the next few slides, then we have a rule that was put in place to determine what happens next. Next slide, please. So the CRR settlement rule was put in place to recapture, where warranted, the increase in CRR revenues to the CRR holders that are attributable to that company's convergence bidding. Next slide, please. And then this one kind of clicks through. So if you could do there, I think there's 2 points on this slide, and we'll just click through those. So there's four rules. This slide lists the first two. So the following criteria will determine if the CRR settlement rule should be applied. Number one, did a convergence bid have an impact on the constraint, and is the convergence bidding entity also a CRR holder? If they are, then we move on to number two. If they are a convergence bidder but they don't have any CRR, then this doesn't apply. So then number two, if they are a convergence bidder and they have CRR, was the directional flow impact greater than 10% of the thermal limit of the line? If yes, proceed to number three, and if no, then the CRR settlement will not apply. Next slide, please. And then if you could click through the animation to point number four, thank you. So here we have number three is each convergence bid that impacted the constraint will be analyzed for an adjustment payout amount by each hour. And I had some notes about that I wanted to share. So after the hourly analysis, we will get an aggregated effect to the CRR portfolio. And then number four, if it is determined that the CRR portfolio profited from the impact in flow caused by that company's convergence bid, the collective amount will be charged back to that scheduling coordinator ID, that scheduling coordinator that holds those CRRs. So that's kind of how that all plays out. Does anybody have any questions on that? I know it's a lot of things to visualize.
Should probably just mention about the rule change that's working its way through right now. And convergence bidding on intertie, since a lot of folks are intertie or potential intertie participants here.
Yeah, so there is a discussion going on about the, are you talking about not the HAPS reversal?
No, just the CRR clawback.
Yeah, and I've talked to Michael before. I forgot what was the change that they were doing?
So if I can summarize it appropriately, I guess it's intertie and internal, so everything, but it's... if I get this correct, if your buyback is less than the day-ahead price, it doesn't matter if you're over the 10% threshold because it's determined that you weren't trying to. And yeah.
But had to do with the HAPS reversal, though, the buyback that you do for the F&M, right? And I kind of on the periphery of this one, so I don't
know well enough to summarize for everybody.
Yeah.
But the paper is only 8 pages long.
There you go. So there is a change that he brought up that's being discussed. But there is actually, from what I understand, though, there's a lot of debate about whether this is necessarily a beneficial thing or not, too, somebody was saying. Or people have different perspective on whether it's a beneficial thing. It sounded to me like it was going to be a good thing, but some people were, there was something else related to it that... The
load aggregation points part of it.
Oh, load aggregation and trading hubs are no longer exempt from it.
But I think the rest of it was pretty, it seemed to sail through pretty well.
And okay.
Get it to the board in June.
Cool.
And then also convergence bidding on interties and just updating folks on.
I don't have an update on convergence bidding at the interties. I believe my latest information was that we intended to move forward with convergence bidding on the interties. I believe the Department of Market Monitoring report to the board suggested that we not. I believe based on a lack of liquidity for the number of bids at the ties that it wouldn't be appropriate to actually open up convergence bidding at the ties until a later date, which I don't know what that date is. That's the most current information that I have, but one of the challenges that I have in the role that I'm doing is I kind of focus on whatever it is today. So the things that are coming and changing in the future, I pay a little bit less attention to because I'm just trying to share, like, this is what it's like today. And then sometimes when that changes, then I have to update that. But I have less of a sense of the future changes, unfortunately. Next slide, please. And then, oh, here's the wrap-up. So we've reached the end. So really what we wanted to do here is, number one, make sure that the questions that you had when you came in here this morning or when you dialed in on the phone, we haven't had any phone people make any comments, that those questions were answered for you. That's the purpose of this, is to not only give you an overview of what CRRs are. I keep saying that. I have to find a better... but, you know, make sure that you not only have that basic understanding, but also have these questions answered. So think about that for a moment and see if you have any lingering things that you'd like to ask us. You can move to the next slide, please. I think that's just a picture of a lady with questions. And then if you can move to the next slide, please. I think we have some upcoming meetings that we wanted to announce. So we have a transmission access charge options meeting. That's happening here in Portland, but at a different location, the collective agency. It looks like you need to RSVP by the end of this week to that email address listed on the screen right there. Space is limited to the first 60 people for that room. You can also dial in on the web. So that is that stakeholder initiative call. If you move to the next slide, we also have the very next day a regional resource adequacy stakeholder initiative. That will be at the same location, RSVP to the same email address by the end of this week to participate in that. So this is where you can go to have a discussion about TAC and about regional resource adequacy, what that might look like, getting your input and your stakeholder comments shared with that larger group. And then we have an additional, if you can move to the next slide, one more meeting that we wanted to announce, and this is actually the PacifiCorp Regional Integration Customer Meeting, Part 2, in this exact room that we are in today toward the end of June. And so that there was an announcement or an email that PacifiCorp had sent out about that. You can be here in person or you can participate on the phone for that as well. I did want to point out that we do have a number of number of links and references and where to go for more information in the reference section in the slides that we shared with you today. And for those folks of you that are in the room with us today, we also passed out evaluation forms. So if you wouldn't mind taking a few moments when we end this session to think about the information that we shared with you today, what you liked about it, what you feel like we could do better. I'm always trying to improve the information that we're sharing with you folks. So candid feedback is definitely welcome. And let's turn it over to you now to see any lingering questions that you have that you'd like to. We've got some time. We have this room until 3, so. Any questions? Yes.
I was just reading over this merchant transmission slides that were earlier on. Is at a high level, is that if you're a transmission owner, you can forego collection of any TAC or WAC and then instead just basically take the pricing difference for the whole capacity of your line for 30 years?
There's two entities that have merchant transmission with our current market structure, and they were actually pre-MRTU before we went to the LMP market. It's kind of a double-edged sword because you build transmission, and what does it do? It relieves constraints, hopefully. By relieving constraints, it lowers the value of any CRs you're going to get. So most people, I think, are going to try for the revenue rate recovery structure. I guess you could say if there's an area that you're building in, maybe you have a generator that you're building in, and you're building a constraint, maybe you build enough for your generator but not for the next generator that's going to come on or something, and so there's still a possibility that there's going to be more congestion. That might be something that might be beneficial, but we haven't seen it to date yet, though. So, yeah, you read through it. It's tough to go just CRs for merchant transmission and assume you're going to recover your costs that way.
It looks like we have a question on the phone. Allie, if you'll go ahead. Two questions on the phone. So go ahead and we'll take those.
Hi, Hi, this is Sarah Davis from Seattle City Light. I was just wondering if the presentation slides could be made available electronically.
Chris, can you tell me where the presentation slides are posted?
For this?
Yes.
Okay, now I'm back.
Okay, so
the slides for this presentation are located in the ISO integration project folder on our OASIS website.
On the PacifiCorp website?
Yes.
Great, thank you.
Do we have a second question on the phone?
Go ahead, Bridget.
They muted.
Bridget,
I'm not sure.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if the CRR market is regulated by the CFTC, and if it's not, have you heard of it?
I think you're saying is it regulated by the CFTC?
Correct.
No.
It's the financial.
And that was the big debate, right, between CFTC and FERC a while back. And so there were some mechanisms put in play, I would say some financial creditworthiness checks put into play that now the ISOs have anybody that is participating has to show, you know, they have credit risk procedures in place. So there was some stuff that was put in, added as a result of that discussion between CFTC and FERC. But for right now, I haven't heard anything new, at least at this point.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
I just want to say thank you to PacifiCorp and Free Books for coming up and doing this and for humoring all the questions that we have since we aren't all transacting in this all the time or trying to learn it. And you know, a lot of the regional integration conversations are happening up at the nicer offices in the top of our buildings, and questions are starting to flow down about some of the more detailed stuff. And I just, as much as there's time to come and do these sorts of things for us, it's definitely appreciated from this side of the table, so we can, you know, learn more about the things that are going to be impacting us on the ground in the future, versus kind of the six-page summaries of the TAC stuff. So.
Yeah, the exchange of information is always beneficial. I mean, as we go through this and start moving through, you know, decisions should be made with good information, not with what if or we think it's this way. So that's the intent, is get the information, then have you go back and figure out what the business solution, what makes sense from a business perspective. So we appreciate PACU and letting us come and use their facilities, too.
I think we don't have any additional questions on the phone, so people in the room, going once, going twice. Are we good? Okay, thank you very much. Allie, we're going to go ahead and conclude the session today. Thank you very much for your attendance on the phone, and we look forward to interacting with you again in the future. Thank you.